Hello, everyone, and welcome to Between the Sheets, episode 26. I am your host, Chris Zellner, and I am joined this evening by my co-host, David Bixenspan, or as he's known in some circles, the Buckler. Bix, how you been with...
I'm good. I'm guessing most people hadn't seen that until I tweeted that earlier. That was weird. Should I explain what you're talking about?
Yeah, go ahead and explain it real quick.
Me and various other people on MMA Twitter were talking about Kenny Florian plagiarizing from a guy for an article for Fox Sports. And whatever the wording was he used, I joked that it was the same thing when Online World of Wrestling, for whatever reason, had posted a couple of my Bleacher Report articles years ago. And they said, you know, they had, like, that it was like a guest column from me. And they had my name, but then they'd also, even though this was without permission from me, your Bleacher Report, by the way, and then... It says, though, by David Buckler. Like, it would be one thing if it was like, okay, we're trying to make it, you know, obfuscate that it was taking something I had written. But it says, here's a guest column for David Bixenspan, you know, that type of thing. But then it says, no, by David Buckler.
Do you think it's one of those deals like back in the old days in entertainment with Jewish actors had to change their last name to something that was non-Jewish that they were trying to, you know, send you a message?
I have those New York values, so.
Oh, yeah. And by that laugh, we are joined this evening by one of the Place to Be Nation stalwarts on the network from Titans of Wrestling, This Week in Wrestling, reaction shows, other various appearances, our good old buddy Pete, how you doing?
Doing great, man. How are you guys doing?
All right, it's Pete's first time on this show, so we got another rookie, so that's always good to have. But anyway, we are discussing the week that was January the 12th through the 18th, 1996,
20 years ago,
and man, do I feel old looking at some of this stuff and thinking, holy shit, this has been 20 years. And we're going to start off with the World Wrestling Federation, and we're starting with some injury news. As the 123 Kid has been in physical therapy for a hip injury and missed the entire last tour, but will be back for the Royal Rumble. Now, Sid Vicious suffered a neck injury on December the 9th, and it got progressively worse. Now, after that, the Nassau Coliseum show, he was pulled from the semi-main event and moved to a prelim match in New Haven, where he was asked to put over his friend Bob Holly, which he did, and then left. The boys all, or many, came to the conclusion that his injury was a work, and he left over being asked to put Holly over in a prelim singles match. He's supposed to be out of action for 8 weeks, but there may have been contact with WCW, either from him or WCW, also believing that he was gone from WWF and talking about bringing him in. But because of past problems, WCW decided not to pursue the situation. Now, Pete, we've talked about Sid's problems in WCW, the whole deal with Arn Anderson, and this is now a little over 2 years since that happened. But of course, we know that, you know, Sid eventually came back to WCW 3 years later. But Sid, in this whole time period, was just one of the most interesting guys in wrestling, because he was always, if he wasn't in WWF, he was always talking about being in either WWF or WCW. He was just like one of the hottest free agents in the business. What were your thoughts about Sid in this time period, in the mid-90s?
You know, he was always over. So he always had a spot. Either he'd always bounce back through the years between the WWF and WCW, usually in a high spot where he got paid a lot of money. He was never like this work rate master, but it didn't really matter. I mean, he had that charisma that the audience really drew into. Vince always had the barometer was the garden knew was where they, you know, where the earmarks were, and he always got over in the garden, and I think that meant a lot for Vince, and I think that's why he kept on bringing Sid back over the years and stuff. But he always had a place to land between the two. I mean, he was there to the dying days until he messed up then that disgusting a leg injury in WCW, but he's always been around and stuff, you know, between two companies in the pretty much from 92 to whatever, 99.
Yeah, and Bix, Sid was out with this injury for a while. I think he first showed back up on Memphis television, coincidentally, as an announcer. He worked a taping with Corey and Dave. Lance was off that week. And it was the week that Mankind made his debut in Memphis.
Yes.
That was before he was in WWF, I think, Mankind, the character.
They might have. I'm trying to remember when they started the vignettes.
It was an early version of it, yeah.
I'm trying to think. Because on Memphis TV, he was still Mankind the Mutilator, right?
Yes.
At least the first couple weeks.
Yes.
I don't remember. Now, in all of this, I'm also trying to remember, was this the end of him on WWF TV until July?
Yes.
And was he under contract the whole time?
The way it talks, he wasn't, you know, if WCW was pursuing him, although who knows at that time period if stuff like that even mattered, you know, with WCW. But
well, what I'm trying to think about also is, did he return before or after Bash at the Beach?
I can look at that real quick.
When I think about who, because it was in July, when I think about all of the people that were named as, you know, possibilities of the third man for the NWO team, I don't remember Sid ever coming up. It was always Hogan, Davey Boy Smith, Luger, Brett, but never Sid.
Didn't he replace Warrior?
Yes.
It had been after Mania.
It was in July. No, it was in July.
He returned in June, actually, but it okay. Yeah, they announced his return in late June, replacing Warrior, and he made the save on Raw on June 24th. He saved Shawn Michaels and Ahmed Johnson from a beatdown.
Okay, so it was still
from Camp Cornette.
That Sid return in June is also like a really great angle, and it's one of my favorite WWE things because they just kind of scrambled and did it. Like, I don't remember exactly when they taped it, but it was like, it wasn't at the Raw tapings where that episode of Raw was. It was like at a house show the previous weekend, and I think they also edited Warrior's match off, something like that, but they scrambled it together and it looked seamless and it was really cool, and Sid speeds up in a car and they're trying to get him over being crazy, and honestly, it's probably one of the best things they ever did with Sid.
Yeah, I mean, considering that, you know, the quick turnaround, because it was on the Raw the week after Warrior's last appearance, where, you know, I think while Warrior was wrestling, they were doing the announcement during the match, right, about how he screwed him over.
Yeah, the appearance bond. I don't remember if that was the same show or the week before, but yeah, it was. That was a whole, and that the best thing about that was also that was a shoot. That's what they were really asking him.
It was a shoot burial in the air.
Now as far as Sid, like, so I guess, yeah, so we're not sure if he's under contract to WWE and he goes to Memphis. Now, was he wrestling in Memphis during the break?
No.
So he didn't really do any wrestling between January and June and July. So I guess
not much.
So that probably was an injury then.
I'm pretty sure it was.
I mean, it kept going. Now, was
Cowboy... it wasn't softball season, was it?
That's a good question that I wouldn't know the answer to.
Yeah,
so
I have no idea what softball
season. I can't speculate on that one.
Was Cowboy Seth around in Memphis yet?
No. No, Memphis was still, you know, doing some of the Smoky Mountain stuff, although that was kind of phasing out. But anyway.
Did Cowboy Seth show up later in the year?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
All right. Back to WWF. There were several Royal Rumble changes over the weekend. Wib sit out of action with a disc problem in his neck. The WWF Tag Titles match was changed to the Body Donnas as challengers for the Smoking Guns. Also in the Rumble will be the Headhunters, who will go by the name of the Squat Team. And we've talked about this ad nauseum on this show. We love the Headhunters. Now, more about the Rumble. The situation with Sabu in the Rumble got even stranger and left the WWF totally frustrated by the end of the week. It was presumed to be a dead deal last week when Paul Heyman convinced Sabu not to work the show after Sabu initially had friends contact J.J. Dillon. WWF agreed to use him initially, presumably for the same $5,000 figure that they were offering other outsiders for one shots. They were also going to allow him to bring his own table and break it by diving over the top, eliminating himself so he can get his gimmick over in a major pay-per-view show, and were also going to allow him to use his name. Now, after Heyman put the kibosh to the deal and made it very public at the ECW Arena show, the CyberSlam 96, a skit which Dave presumed Heyman put together to make sure everyone knew in case Sabu did do it, that he'd be able to portray it as a slap in the face to ECW fans and thus enable him to face down or get rid of the popular Sabu, who once again let down his loyal fans if he were to do the show. Early in the week, Sabu was convinced by those same friends and business acquaintances, including NWA promoter Dennis Corluzzo,
awesome,
who has a longstanding rivalry with Heyman, to not listen to Heyman and agree to do the Rumble anyway. Sabu told them he would at least consider it, if not outright do it. Sabu, instead of making a call to WWF, put everything in the hands of his uncle, the Sheik, who at first nixed the WWF, and later in the week, after being offered a booking payoff, rumored to be $3,000 from Bruce Pritchard,
awesome,
which may have included him accompanying Sabu to ringside, although that isn't clear, changed his tune and agreed for Sabu to do the show. WWF then taped Royal Rumble promos with Sabu's name being part of the show during the latter part of the week, and the WWF announced on its hotline that Sabu, quote, from ECW, unquote, would be in the Rumble. Pritchard then offered Heyman several WWF wrestlers to work at ECW in exchange for using Sabu, but Heyman said that he wasn't interested. Heyman then put pressure on Sabu once again, and Sabu once again backed out of the deal. Heyman doesn't want any of his performers to appear on a WWF pay-per-view show before he does a pay-per-view show of his own. That's funny. Both because he says he promised those willing to put him on pay-per-view that he would have entirely different performers in WWF and WCW, and also because he's wanted to avoid the perception problem of being a minor league feeder system to WWF, which would hurt in the pay-per-view marketplace. Now, the next week, Heyman promised Sabu that he'd headline an ECW pay-per-view show before June the 12th. There is no definite date as of yet for an ECW pay-per-view show. Dix, this is full of so much bullshit. It is hilarious.
It defines the – I mean, it's so carny, everything about it.
Well, my favorite part is, though, Sabu would have eliminated himself diving onto a to put someone through a table.
No, put himself through a table is what it said. Yeah.
But either way, one or the other.
Yeah.
He's going to be Sabu. He's not going to really get hurt in this. Like, I mean, get hurt as an entity, obviously, going through a table would be an issue. I mean, I don't know how Paul Heyman thinks through this stuff, but you know what? Maybe he saw what was happening with the Headhunters. Like, that's the only thing I can think of that he was worried that something like that would happen to Sabu because...
Well, Shane Douglas.
I think if Sabu gets to be Sabu in the Rumble, then it's a win for everyone.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah, God.
If anything other than Sabu being Sabu and going through a table to eliminate himself happens, then I can understand why Heyman wouldn't want to do it and why Sabu would be going back and forth. But... as we know it, that they had the whole thing with him eliminating himself in place, I don't think it's a problem, especially because it's Sabu. He has the wild man gimmick. He's also someone who's not made to look like an idiot if he eliminates himself. You know what I mean?
Or his,
like,
character.
Yeah, there's nothing there that really hurts him. So I don't know. And also, I love that his uncle almost got himself a $3,000 payoff for doing nothing.
Yeah. So much carny stuff.
What a great businessman that man is, the Sheik.
Yeah, and Heyman just spouting all this crap out, which in retrospect is just so hilarious.
June 12th.
Yeah, don't want to be seen as a WWF feeder system.
Right. Oh, a year, God, and a half later, here's Darren Drozdov and Brakus.
It's amazing, but... I think Pete, part of the deal with Heyman was Sabu just returned in November from, you know, that short stint in WCW. And Heyman and Sabu have been battling off and on for over a year now, outside the ring. And I guess Paul just did not – he had his plans for Sabu that we know, so he just didn't want to fuck him up because the Taz angle started in November, and that's what it was, you know, building up to, was the eventual Taz-Sabu match. So he didn't want his grand plans fucked up.
I can see that, and I mean, I guess Heyman had a big picture in place, but I mean, there's so much bullshit right through the lines here. I mean, this is so Paul Heyman, this whole entire paragraph or five. It's just, it makes you wonder how long does he have Sabu under contract for? If I was a WWF at the time, I sure in heck would never want to deal with Sabu ever again or Paul Heyman. And I mean, this looks just like a headache. And they're wasting their time going through, yes, he's coming, no, he's not, for a shot. And I'm with Bix, where I don't think it would hurt Sabu because he's going to be Sabu and he's going to go out on his deal. But I can see where Heyman wanted to protect him in his own. But being considered a former WWF guy, I don't think that's going to hurt his pay-per-view buys. And to me, telling him he's going to have a whole new cast of characters, I don't think that helps him on the pay-per-view and stuff.
Yeah, it is what it is, I tell you. I mean, that's classic Paul Heyman.
Exactly. Anyway,
according to an item in the January 14th Boston Herald, another name considered for the Rumble that didn't materialize was boxer Peter McNeely. According to the item, McNeely, now famous for being in a pizza commercial, Pizza Hut, where he knocks himself out trying to eat a pizza, was invited and would have been tossed out in 89 seconds, the same time as fight with Mike Tyson the year earlier. And his manager, Vinny Verone, who I haven't thought about in 20 years, was going to interfere as a spoof on the Tyson fight. According to Verone, the Titan told him to name his figure, but when he did, they never called back. No doubt his figure was well above the $5,000 Titan was offering outsiders for participation. The fly in the ointment, so to speak, on the story is that McNeely would have been thrown out of the ring by The Undertaker. Undertaker, of course, is not in the Rumble, nor has he ever been scheduled for it any time in the planning, as Bret versus Undertaker as the main event was on the books many months ago. McNeely had a very brief part in the UFC pregame show in his last pay-per-view, getting exactly 89 seconds on an interview before being given the hook. Peter McNeely, you know, he was Mike Tyson first fought when he got out of prison. Huge pay-per-view buys. I mean, it wasn't all because of him, it was because of Tyson, but a huge pay-per-view fight, and he made, you know, himself famous for, you know, getting knocked out in 89 seconds, doing pizza commercials and stuff like that, making the rounds in the media.
But what was the deal with the manager running in the ring, though? I'm trying to remember.
He was trying to say that the fight got stopped too early.
He ran in, like, right away, didn't he?
Yes. Yeah, he was definitely hamming it up, so... But it was just one of those weird deals. I mean, total tomato can type stuff. So, but yeah, he had his 30 seconds or I guess 89 seconds of fame, you could say. So, WWF though this time, I could see them wanting to do that though, Bix. You know, for that
absolutely
freak show factor.
And I just looked up on Wikipedia: 1.52 million pay per view buys.
Impressive, Mike Tyson, baby. I mean, that's the power
now. I mean,
I know.
But yeah, of course. I mean, yeah, that's the type of thing they love. I mean, well, when the fight was I mean, that was in August.
Yeah.
But it still would have been kind of fresh. I mean, things moved at a different pace back then.
Exactly. Nowadays, I mean, he would have been, you know, lost in the shuffle maybe a week or two after the fact.
Yeah, and I'm trying to remember because it was around this time too, I feel like. Who the whole Andrew Galata low blow fight? Who was that against?
Riddick Bowe.
Okay, because I remember that became famous, but I don't remember because it seems weird. Like because it seemed like it got more attention than it was worth. So I was trying to remember. Wait, it wasn't Tyson, but
yeah, Andrew. Well, Andrew Galata was beating Riddick Bowe. You know, I mean. It was in July of 96, so it's after this.
Okay, because I'm just thinking about because that was another thing WWE got in on, you know, was calling a low blow a Galata.
Yeah, Galata was a big deal, and then he had a rematch in December where he got DQ'd again.
They did that for years, too, because that was a China thing, like, Attitude Era, right?
Yeah, well, Galata was still fighting major fights until the end of the decade. He fought
but he wasn't low-blowing people every time.
No, but if I remember right, he got DQ'd against Tyson.
Okay. I've got to look this up.
But yeah, Pete, like I said, classic WWF wanting to bring in the freak show celebrity to, get involved. This is what they do.
And McNeely had some like charisma about him too. I mean, he was kind of like Rocky, except for he was Irish and he was a bum. You know, and yeah, it's perfect. I mean, they were always trying to find that type of that niche. I mean, they're always looking for those like boxers from Tyson to Buster Douglas to McNeely. I think they even tried something with Tommy Morrison at one point.
Yeah,
did they?
There was something going on there. I can't remember if it was anything that was like big or anything, but I know that they were talking about something would do with Tommy Morrison once.
And Galata lost by TKO to Tyson.
Okay, there we go. Okay, so one DQ. All right, anyway, Raw highlights for the week include a great video feature on Shawn Michaels and a great hallway brawl with Razor Ramon and Goldust. Despite everyone claiming Jim Cornette has nothing to do with booking, his DNA was all over the Ramon Goldust angle, complete with them brawling out of the building and the heel getting into his car and driving off as the face throws something at the car. The brawl was much stiffer than you'd expect from WWF or anyone else for that matter, but it was actually Bruce Pritchard who produced the segment. Now, other parts of the show really reeked of desperation. Vince McMahon had to read what sounded like a lawyer's statement that Goldust doesn't represent the gay community and that the subject matter is harassment. Geez, and Dave thought they were portraying the worst imaginative homophobia to the nth degree. But Dave also thought the gangsters in Smoky Mountain was playing on racism, but it had nothing to do with that. It was all about the fact that lots of whites hate blacks and that maybe that was some wrestling ticket. They also did a spot where Sonny was wearing a very low-cut top and bent over as much as possible under the guise of shooting pool. What was last week's slogan? Oh, yeah, nothing artificial here. A second spot saw her in a bubble bath, implying she'd had sex for the past hour. And Dave had this great closing line. Hey, it works on silk stockings. All right, Pete.
I have a question for you first. Who was that that you said that they said that Goldust does not represent?
The gay community.
Really? Who was that again?
The gay community.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Pete, your thoughts on...
Very similar accent.
Your thoughts on the Ramon Goldust angle? I thought that was one of the better angles they did in this time period.
It really was, but then they eventually chickened out on it all because what was it? Razor was claiming that his son's, I guess it was Cody Hall, was going to school, and they were saying his dad was I hate to use the term, but calling him a fag.
The gay community.
The gay community. It was really cutting edge for 1996. And they had that really good match. What was it? Was that the Rumble?
I don't remember them having any really good matches. But
I remember, like, I remember liking one.
What is it? Was it In Your House?
Their pay-per-view match was the Rumble, though. Yes.
Okay, that's right. Yeah, yes.
But I remember them, Ramon, did Goldust kiss Ramon, or did he get the finish changed?
Him getting the finish change sounds right. That it ended up being 1-2-3 Kid running in to
okay. Help maybe us. It wasn't a good match, but I just remember it being reeking of something. Maybe it was controversy because Razor didn't want to get kissed on the lips by Goldust, which again, you know, the gay community thing.
And
he had that machismo,
you know.
Yeah, I mean they were two characters that played off each other really well. But I guess, and you know, some people just can't get over that, you know. But I always thought it was a really cool angle and a cool cool pairing between the two of them.
Yeah. Now, Bix, this is like the early beginnings of the Sonny mega push.
Yes.
And, they definitely, this is them for the first time actually doing this type of stuff with a female character.
Yeah, now, what was the disclaimer they'd have a read? That the show contains action of a graphic nature, I believe?
Yeah.
Of a graphic nature.
Yeah.
Discretion is advised. Which, I'm trying to remember, I think the first week it was just a graphic for when they aired the Brett Baldock match from In Your House, right?
Correct.
And then they started having her do her thing, and this is the big, it's weird, it's almost weird to think about knowing how they are now. That they really did stay away from overt sexualization of women before this point.
A long time, yeah.
I mean, I guess you could say, what, the Liz workout poster would be the closest?
Well, or Liz, you
know. Or Liz in the bikini at SummerSlam, yeah. This is a way the company still, I mean, I guess you could say still does business now, or is at least theoretically trying to get away from.
Yeah, they've gone back to the old ways, yeah.
Just very... like when you think of just how other territories were and stuff, like, you know, Memphis and world class to a point, and like other places that use female valets, I mean, they were the exception. Not that there's anything wrong with it. It's just, it's surprising in hindsight. And also, they really, for her first, however long she was there, like, I don't know, what would you say? It was like 9 months that she had been there?
She was there.
As a valet?
Yeah, she was there as a...
Maybe a little longer?
Like late spring, maybe?
Yeah, so a little less than that. Yeah. And they really didn't push her, like, as a sex symbol that much either then. Like, it was really...
No, they didn't. No, she was, like, a total bitch. You know, she was the workout, you know, bitch. You know, she was just in her spandex and stuff. It wasn't until late 95 when they started going that way, when she started wearing different, like, normal outfits, you would say.
Right. Right. And
yeah, kind of when she was going from team to team type of thing, as, like, the whore slash manager.
Yeah. The whore manager, yeah. She was on the Smoking Guns to the Godwins.
For its time, it was actually kind of a fantastic gimmick.
Yeah,
it was. It was 20 years later, it feels wildly offensive.
It was cute. Yeah, it was cute.
I mean, they always made it clear, though, that she was not... That she was really just going for the team who had the belts, which I thought was a clever spin on it.
And I think that was originally, it was kind of like she was doing that to make the Body Donnas jealous or something like that. Or she was doing it for other reasons. That she was really with the Body Donnas, but, you know, she was...
Well, you know, no, because they transitioned, because it was only like a week or two that it took to transition her from the Body Donnas to the Godwins to the Guns.
Yeah, that's right.
And then the Body Donnas just kind of turned babyface by default.
Yeah, which was weird. More about the Body Donnas later. The final show at the Forum in Montreal took place on January the 12th. They shot an angle after Smoking Guns beat Owen and Davey, where Raymond Rougeau, who did the In the Stands ring announcing, tried to interview them after the match. Owen started insulting the Rougeau family and said that Quebec should have done everyone a favor and separated from Canada. As Rougeau walked away in disgust, Owen ambushed him and beat the hell out of him. This no doubt sets up a Hart versus Rougeau match for the August 2nd wrestling debut in the new 24,000-seat Molson Center. Now, Jean-Pierre Lafitte, who's been out of action since November after undergoing hernia surgery, was asked by Montreal promoter Joanne Rougeau, sister of Jacques and Raymond, about the rumor of him joining Jacques in WCW. Jacques had tried all week to conclude his deal with WCW so he could get in with all the local newspapers to steal the thunder from the WWF show, but the deal wasn't put together in time. Pierre told Joanne that he had a WCW offer after his WWF contract expires in July, but he agreed to no deal. He said he preferred to stay with WWF and wished all the Quebec connection would bury the hatchet and stay with WWF, but said WCW is talking guaranteed money and he has to look out for his family. Jacques claimed that the WWF angle with Raymond was a sign of desperation. Raymond made a point of telling people that unlike Jacques, he never said he was retiring and never had a retirement show. Also at the Montreal show, a member of the Canadiens, whose name Dave didn't get, but he's a goon type, but wasn't on the road trip to Pittsburgh because of an injury, kept trying to hit on Sonny. After being turned down a second time, he apparently got very vulgar and crude with her, and Diesel heard the commotion and stepped out and basically told the guy that if he didn't want to be on disabled list a lot longer, to leave her alone. He took one look at the size of Diesel and apparently slinked off. Maybe somebody who listens to this show can tell us who the goon was, because I really don't remember. But that's quite the story there, Bix. But the Rougeau family dissension, that carried for a while, if I'm not mistaken, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, now I'm just trying to remember all the details here, because you talked about the Owen Raymond thing that ended up being a boxing match, I believe, at the Molson Center opening, right?
Yes.
And then,
that sounds right.
Yeah, so I'm trying to remember the whole timeline of the split there, because who was the local promoter when Jacques was still in the WWF?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Because no was clue. It a family member?
It may have been the sister. It could have been the sister. Yeah, it was a boxing match, and Owen had Georges Chevalo, the legendary Canadian boxer, in his corner.
That's right. So all I remember is, you know, Jacques ends up going to WCW. He's going to promote or, you know, have his own shadow promoter. And Joanne stuck with WWF, and there was the whole split there. And I mean, it's interesting that they're still at this point kind of trying to give Montreal custom programs and all that, which was a Pat Patterson thing. And this is kind of the end of it, right? I don't think they did anything after that match.
No,
did they?
This was, yeah. The fact the last you really heard of Montreal was the whole Bret Shawn deal.
Right. And
Montreal became just another city until, you know, WCW was doing the Hogan and Jacques thing, you know, but.
Right. And Pat LaPrade and Bertrand Herbert's, I hope I'm getting it right, book, you know, their Montreal history. It's great, but for some reason, my favorite chapter was the WWF chapter because it talks about all the, like, interesting custom booking they did for Montreal and who was headlining. Like, even, like, six-man tags with Ronnie Garvin headlining when he was in the WWF and stuff like that. Like,
it was, yeah.
Like, it was interesting. And they also, like, the last really big program, though, was when they did the whole Quebecer split that led into the Jacques pseudo-retirement match against Pierre, which, for those who have never seen it, there are highlights on YouTube, and it's awesome. Have you seen that?
I got a question about the six-man tags, though, with Garvin. Were they promoting him as a French-Canadian on those six-man tags, or was he still Ronnie Garvin, the trucker?
You mean, were they outright saying he is French-Canadian? Well, I guess I'll ask this. Chris, like, when he was wrestling in international and stuff, did they portray him as being someone originally from the area?
I think it was one of those deals where it was known.
Because the accent and stuff.
Yeah, it was known. I mean, there was one of those things where they outright did it. It was just known. And I think they, if I'm not mistaken, the whole Rougeau's Garvin's angle played, like, originally played off of heat between the families.
Okay.
Going back to, you know, Jacques' dad.
Right. And
know,
either way, he was an established star in Montreal.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And then regarding the YouTube match, I have never seen the highlights of it. I sounds like I need to check it out. But I've never seen it.
Super heat. It's like there's a couple things that they repeat in the clips for some reason, but it's really good. Like if I'm guessing Pete's never seen it either. Like if you haven't seen it, it's really good. I think it's still up there. It's on Carl Willett's channel.
Okay, well, that sounds awesome. All right, some TV notes for the week: the Bret Hart Buddy Landell match taped on December 18th, 95 in Newark, Delaware, aired on the January 13th episode of WWF Mania. And on the January 13th episode of Superstars, taped on December 19th in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, Jeff Hardy defeated WWF Intercontinental Champion Razor Ramon by countout in an untitled match when Razor chased Goldust Usher backstage after the Usher came out and distracted the champion with a centerfold of Goldust. After the bout, Razor returned to the ring, hit the Razor's Edge on Hardy three times, then threatened several officials who came out to restrain him. Now, Pete, I know me and Bix have talked about the Bret Buddy Landell match before on this show, but if you've seen it, what are your thoughts about it?
Man, I have not seen it, tell you the truth, or I haven't seen it in years, let me put it that way.
Okay, you need to check it out. You need to check it out because, I mean, considering what happened to Buddy, it's Buddy's last really strong match. It's not a great match because it's short, but it's you could tell they were going to do something with him, and then his injury happened, and, you know, it was what it was.
Well,
but
a few hours later, right?
Yeah.
That night, wasn't it?
Yeah, a few hours later. Now, Bix, Jeff Hardy. Let's see. This is December 19th, 1995.
He's 17.
He's 17. No, he's 18.
When's his birthday?
August 31st. So he's 18 years old. And my question was he legal? And he was. But Jeff Hardy was a jobber on WFTV quite a bit in this time period.
Yeah, I mean, Matt was too. This is when they both really started to be on TV regularly as job guys.
Yeah.
Like, they had started getting work in 94, but this is when they were really there a lot.
Yeah.
And they were kind of – I'm trying to remember, like, were they getting to show offense at all yet, or was that not
– depended on the opponents, I think.
Okay.
So, yeah. But I always thought they were, like, in the Barry Hardy. Because I remember Barry Hardy was a jobber, you know, doing the television. So I thought, oh, it's Barry Hardy's like young brothers or whatever. No, Ken, obviously. A couple other TV notes, non-WWF television, but involving WWF people. Shawn Michaels taped a Jenny Jones episode on January 12th. Not sure the air date, where a guy who is a wrestling fanatic gets to meet his favorite wrestler. And then Razor Ramon took the Jerry Springer Show on January 15th doing a Make-A-Wish gimmick. Now, yes, folks, Jerry Springer at one point had a serious type show. This is kind of near the end of that era.
Yeah,
but
this is, I think, like when he's in transition. Still got some of the, like, he's starting to be the Jerry Springer we know, but he's still Donahue knockoff Jerry Springer.
Yeah.
To a point.
And we'll talk about Donahue later in the show. That's a great talking point there.
Great non-segue.
Yeah, and Shawn Michaels, have either of you ever seen this Jenny Jones show?
Not this show. I've seen the Jenny Jones show.
I don't think so.
I've never seen one with Michaels.
All right, Shawn Michaels on this show. Yeah, I don't know if it's on YouTube or not, but he came off as such a douchebag. I mean, it was so like condescending towards this fan. It was like, it was a guy too. I mean, it was I don't know how old the guy was, but I mean, he was probably in his 20s or whatever, but it definitely, like, Shawn was just there for the payday, and yeah, it was not a great look. So, anyway.
How much would he get paid for that?
Oh, who knows? Who knows? Who knows what those thoughts were done? Maybe somebody, I'll ask Jamie Dundee about that, what the payoffs were.
That's a good idea. And more on Shawn Michaels and payoffs in a couple minutes.
Yeah. Hunter Hearst Helmsley's character will gradually but definitively change from a snobbish Frenchman to a cocky playboy more aligned with Ric Flair than Steven Regal. The feeling is that the shift in character makes him more so main event material, and plans for him over the next year are so as to promote him to being a top-level heel. this comes from The Torch. And Pete, you know, you could tell that they had plans for him, but
right.
that damn curtain call killed it for a long time.
He was on job duty for a year after that curtain call. I never really saw the transition to a Ric Flair mode. I mean, to actually, you know, for all Hunter's, you know, flaws and stuff, he ended up going in his own direction in a way. But he was, you know, Shawn's. He never really broke through until Shawn got hurt. So I mean, it took him, you know, 2 good years after this, probably.
Yeah, I think the Ric Flair thing that maybe Wade was talking about was when they started adding the valets in the mix.
Right.
So that may have been what it was. But how about that wording there, Bix, the cross between Ric Flair and Steven Regal?
Well, no, he's saying he's going to be more like Ric Flair than Steven Regal.
Yeah. But I'm saying those two guys.
His mentors,
exactly. So an interesting wording there by Wade.
Yes.
Now, Wade also. Go ahead.
I was going to say, as far as like the Ric Flair, I mean, he's like, I guess you could almost say the idea they had was sort of an old money Ric Flair.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, Ric Flair is a guy who became rich and famous doing wrestling. Hunter Hearst Helmsley is a guy who happens to be rich who became a pro wrestler.
Yeah, exactly. Even though if you knew Rick's background, you know, his dad, doctor, and all this other stuff, so. But they never, you know, they never did that type of gimmick with Rick.
Yeah, I mean, his dad was a very successful gynecologist. I mean, so is Rick, but only as a hobby.
Oh, yes. I'm sure Rick has quite the stories involving stirrups. But according to the WWF, it's also from The Torch, the Bonnie Donnas were changed from Skip and Flip to Skip and Zip because a singing duo from the 60s were called Skip and Flip. And it was copyrighted. So, Bix, I think we were talking about this on a previous show. That's why the name was changed.
Yep.
Copyright infringement.
I'll ask you this. Do you think is the better name? I feel like Zip is the better name.
I agree. I think Zip's a better name, too, because Tom Pritchard wasn't a flyer.
And neither is really a good name, but Zip is better. Zip has history in wrestling, even if it's more like a masked man name. So,
yeah.
Zip is better.
Yeah. Now, Shawn Michaels, we talked about money earlier, denies that he'd receive a $2.5 million on an AOL chat session during the week. While that amount may not be exact, or else he's just being protective, the inheritance actually occurred over a year ago, not a few months ago. Now, Bix, we've heard the stories about Shawn Michaels getting this money in the past. Do you know what the concrete figure was?
I think 2.5 million was always the number that floated around. I mean, for those who don't know, the story was always that some fan was wealthy and happened to leave Shawn Michaels $2.5 million. I want to say Dave Meltzer addressed this recently on Observer Radio, and the answer was something along the lines of he had heard it was true, then Michaels would deny it, and things had kind of gone back and forth. Something like that. Like, it's probably true, but Michaels seems to prefer to deny it, was kind of the vibe.
Well, didn't he talk about this on one of his DVDs? I'm trying to remember. I haven't watched the documentaries in years, but I kind of seem to remember that it came up. That he got that he admitted to getting the money somehow, someway, or something like that. Because they hadn't been wondering because his dad was on there or something. Like they were talking about managing his money. Like I said, I'm not for sure on that. I haven't watched it in years, but I kind of remember something about that vaguely. I could be wrong. So
it's still a weird story. I mean, it's
What, you know, a wrestling fan leaves their favorite wrestler $2.5 million.
By the way, nice job making your wrestlers seem like stars. That the fan even felt the need to do that.
Yeah.
Can you imagine how it would be now? The fan would have left even more money.
Oh, God. You know, somebody's, you know, the way the obsession these fans are now. I mean, can you just imagine some of the – if they were rich, who would get payoffs, you know, these days? Oh, my goodness.
Bo Dallas.
I wonder what sicko fan would have floated Benoit if he was still alive and had to face charges. What type of sicko fan would have come out and offered to pay for Benoit's legal fees?
Oh, God. I'm sure somebody would have. We talked about that crew that went to his house, you know, a few weeks ago. And
wait, what?
Was it you? No, it wasn't you I was talking to about this. It was Dylan.
Oh, when, I did not hear about this.
Yeah, it was on the internet where these fans, I think they may have been from England. They were from somewhere not in America, but they were in Fayetteville, Georgia, where Chris Benoit lived when he killed his family. And they went by the house, which, you know, you can't go into, of course, and it's blocked off, but they videoed it and put it on YouTube.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm guessing it's been sold by now. Like, God, can you imagine?
I don't know if anybody lives there. I think it's, like, closed off.
They were trying to sell it at some point.
Yeah, I don't think nobody's bought it. I mean, that's
so
not the
sure, so they, kind of... So I would almost expect then, wouldn't these fans have decided to... You know what? I don't want to think about it.
Yeah, let's move on. Let's move on to a lighter story and to close out the WWF section. Titan got an item plan in the gossip section of the New York Daily News on January 15th and alluded to it on Raw. It read, quote, "Ted Turner is ready to get in the ring with WWF honcho Vince McMahon," say sources. "We hear Turner, the owner of the rival World Championship Wrestling, CNN, and the Atlanta Braves, wants to scout McMahon because the WWF has parodied him in sketches using a tall, thin, mustachioed man with a silly-sounding southern drawl named Billionaire Ted. Turner, who needs this little wrestling outfit like we need a Nehru jacket, wasn't mad because one skit implied his wrestlers use steroids. Rather, say sources, he was angry because he was portrayed as a hillbilly with a bad suit, and Ted's a little sensitive. Added to source, Billionaire Ted doesn't like Billionaire Ted and wants the feud to end," unquote. And Dave said, "Expect a Bischoff response to the item in the paper this week." Now, yeah, we'll talk about this more later when we get WCW, but yeah, this is the beginning of the whole Billionaire Ted, Huckster, Nacho Man stuff in Bix. I mean, that was pretty wild for the time period. I would have never thought that they would do something like that on WWE television.
No. I guess where are we at this point? We're after the second one?
Yes.
Because the second one was the steroid one, I believe.
Yes.
The first one was kind of tame.
Yeah, we're going to talk about this more later, but...
It was just
different, man. I mean, they were just total vindictiveness coming out. Like, wow. You know, these guys are upset. Well, they're feeling the heat.
Well, it was fascinating, too, because, like, the first two, even though, I mean, yeah, there's the whole plan. Well, here's the thing. If this is a WWF planted story, this shows you what Vince's intention is, because the first two did not go after Ted Turner himself that hard.
Oh, no.
But this WWF planted story is like, oh, Ted was pissed because they made him seem like a hillbilly with bad suits. After this, I'm trying to remember exactly when the tide turned. I mean, they slanted very much towards just taking shots at Ted Turner.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Way too much.
I mean, probably the one that sticks out for me is where they...
Larry King?
Did they do one with him, or did they just do it with the Huckster and Nacho? I'm trying to remember how many fake Larry Kings.
I think they did one with just Billionaire Ted.
Okay, because the thing I remember is, and Vince would do this too in interviews, was taking shots at Ted Turner for taking lithium.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean...
He didn't make it sound like it was a mental health drug. He made it sound like it was something he was abusing.
Yes.
It was very weird, and, like, even now, like... You know, I wasn't even 12 years old yet, so I don't know what lithium is, so I figure, like, it is some kind of intoxicant, but no, it's a mood balancer.
Yeah.
Ted Turner was, like, I mean, especially now, when you think about
it. And a great Nirvana song, too, by the way.
Yes, but you think about how things are now, like, Ted Turner deserves a lot of credit for how open he was about, like, his mental health issues and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally.
And here's Vince just shitting all over him for it.
Yeah. Now, Pete, did you come off being sympathetic to Ted in these skits, or did you think that Vince was in the right for doing this type of stuff?
I was more shocked because the WWF never acknowledged the competition. I was more blown away that they actually were acknowledging WCW because they never, ever gave them a platform on their television, unless you count when Ric Flair came over with the belt in late 91.
Yeah, exactly.
It was just more like wow, because they never really acknowledged a period. So the fact that they were acknowledging another wrestling company, I found that more interesting than the actual vindictiveness of the stuff.
And now to switch gears to a whole different direction from Billionaire Ted, we go to All Japan Pro Wrestling and Japan in general. And not a whole lot going on. Yoshinari Ogawa retained his PWF Junior Heavyweight title, defeating Rex King on January the 12th in Takamatsu. Of course, Rex King was Timothy Well of Well Done, one half of Southern Rockers, you know, in the USWA. And he did quite a large amount of tours from All Japan in this era, Vic. So he was a credible opponent for this title.
Yeah, I don't think he ever made TV, though, did he?
I know he made commercial tapes.
Yes.
Because I know a certain tape dealer in Western Pennsylvania has him on his list in commercial tapes.
Okay. Oh, but you know what? I think it was I'm trying to remember. Was it like the... Because you know how they had the two different sets of All Japan commercial tapes? They had the ones that were released by VAP and they had the ones that were released by All Japan.
Yeah.
You're like your major and your minor ones. Which ones was he on?
Oh, I would not know. I would not remember which ones were which.
Anyway. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was it until you jog my memory, it did look weird, but then you say that and like, oh yeah, that's right, he did tour there a lot, but I don't remember ever seeing any of his All Japan matches.
Yeah, I may have seen one or two on handhelds, but I don't think I've ever seen the like stuff on a commercial video. But you know, Ogawa, he was pretty strong back then, even as a junior heavyweight, Pete. I mean, he was a guy that's always been kind of, I wouldn't say push, but he's always on the scene, you know, even today. Yeah, always today. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I always find it interesting when you see these names like Rex King on tour, because I would assume that he got paid less than normal guys they'd bring over, because he knew he was just, you know, getting beat all week long and stuff.
Oh, look at, I mean, for those of you that want, you know, for a little fun, look at like go to the Cage Match or sites like that, WrestlingData.com, and look at like the list of gaijin that was going over like All Japan in the 90s, and it is a varied list of people. You know, we're talking about John Nord last week. You know, here's Rex King. I mean, a lot of names went in and out of All Japan and New Japan in the 90s. But man, All Japan,
Charland.
Yeah, All Japan more often than not, because New Japan would have, you know, work with WCW, but All Japan had no really allies, and they just brought in whoever.
Right. So. New Japan had more of a rotating cast. All Japan, outside of the top guys, didn't really?
No.
Both in the 80s and the 90s, really.
Exactly, yeah. So a lot of cool matchups over the years. All right, this is, I love this story.
Yes.
Battle Arts debuted on January the 13th at Corken Hall before a sellout house. The Battle Arts guys are the remnants of from the defunct pro wrestling Fujiwara Gumi shoot group. And the main event saw Yuki Ishikawa and Shoichi Funaki go over Daisuke Okada and Katsumi Yasuda. Sounds like a fucking awesome match. The style is a combination shoot submission style in the ring and chair throwing brawling style outside the ring. Michinoku Pro and FMW each sent tag matches to the debut show as Battle Arts is sending its wrestlers to work with both groups. Oh, Pete, man, Battle Arts is one of my all-time favorite promotions. And, yeah, Yuki Ishikawa, Daisuke Ikeda, that's like the ultimate feud. What are your thoughts about Battle Arts?
I always loved the promotion. Because it was hard hitting, it was technical, and it was just fun. Because the only thing I never got into the tag matches because the style I always thought was better suited for singles matches. And it might be because me growing up as thinking Southern style wrestling is the only way to go. So it just didn't flow well. But man, these guys were awesome. I mean, Ishikawa is easily one of my favorite workers of all time. And they had so many good matches, and a lot of people it's a promotion that people have slept on throughout the years, I think, and it's something that people just don't really understand. And if you get a chance to watch it, I mean, you'll love it. I've very very met very few people who don't like it once you've given it the time to watch and stuff.
Well, that's an interesting line you just had about how it's perceived, because. You go back, all right, let's go back 12 or 13 years. And Biggs, you know this.
Mm-hmm.
Battle Arts was one of the darlings of the internet wrestling community, which I hate saying.
But, well, the Death Valley Driver board.
Death Valley Driver, you know, they were very important in pushing Battle Arts to a new fan base. And of course, me and you were around that time period, you know, heavily. And I mean, God, I can remember, you know, ordering Battle Arts tapes and just going completely nuts, like the B files and all the other stuff. I mean, Battle Arts, I'm trying to think of what it would be like. What's like today's equivalent of Battle Arts? What would you think would be today's, as far as like niche wrestling promotions, what would be like today's version of Battle Arts?
I don't know. I'm trying to think because Battle Arts had its own style, and everything I can think of doesn't really like.
Well, I don't know if I'm talking about like style, but like fandom, maybe.
No, I know you're saying that, but I'm trying to think because I feel like that's part of the comparison. It doesn't have to have the same style; it just kind of has to have a style.
Would Evolve make you think Evolve?
I was thinking Evolve with the grappling now.
Evolve has the close style, but I don't think they have the type of. Like, I don't think you have the type of people in love. Like, you know, they have it, they're following, but I don't think you have people who absolutely love it the way they did Battle.
But let's be honest here. Battle Arts did run shows in front of, like, 25, 30 people, too.
Well, they had the funding from the guys in the Cosby sweaters in the front row. But, yeah, for me, like, I'm different from, I think, a lot of the Battle Arts fans, though, in that my favorite Battle Arts is your weird shoot style blended with like junior heavyweight style type of stuff.
Minoru Tanaka,
Alexander Otsuka.
But yeah, if you haven't seen Minoru Tanaka's Battle Arts work, my lord, the guy was amazing there.
Stud.
I know our Jilly, I was about to say Jilly departed for him. He's not dead, but he's dead on the wrestling scene. Scott Mailman picks put out that great Minoru Tanaka. Two tape compilation.
Yes.
And it's just filled with great matches from Battle Arts. I mean, fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, not just that stuff. Like, I was never that big a fan of Ikeda versus Ishikawa for some reason. I mean, I loved Ishikawa versus Murakami.
Woo, Murakami. Yes.
That reminds me, I still haven't watched the match from the Tenryu show yet.
Murakami was God in Battle Arts. For that short time he was there. Oh, Jesus.
But also stuff like the Ikeda, that big Ikeda Otsuka match, which I remember loving.
Otsuka was my favorite. I love
Otsuka was my favorite too. I mean, the Diet Butcher. I mean, he was.
Yeah.
it felt like at the time, I think he was kind of everyone's favorite. And yeah, then eventually, I mean, it kind of shifted more towards Ikeda.
Yeah, Ishikawa and Ikeda, you can't deny their greatness, of course. But when it comes to favoritism, Otsuka was my guy.
Yeah, and just loved their matches never really clicked with me that much. And I also like the stuff like later on where you had – where they – again, they just started blending other styles. Like there was that one match. It was Ishikawa and who was his partner against – I think it was Gedo and Masato Tanaka.
Yeah, that was the early years of the Impact Players, you know, indie run.
Complete players,
that's right. Dick Togo and all that crew.
Because there was the Complete Players. Well, no, because I think Dick Togo was Far East Connection, because the Complete Players and the Far East Connection were connected, and they shared guys. But I think he was – it was a whole weird thing.
The Complete Players was Gato, Jado, and Masato Tanaka.
And what's her name? Kaori Nakayama.
Yeah, Kaori Nakayama, that's right. And the Far East Connection, of course, was – Dick Togo, Gato, Tomohiro Ishii, Curry Man, Ikoto Hidaka, and that manager dude. I can't remember his name.
I can't remember the manager at all. But to me, Battle Arts was about blending styles and doing different styles of wrestling, kind of with the pacing and the rhythm of shoot style.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Oh, totally, yeah.
That's what I feel like makes it different from everything else. Because even guys who did similar stuff, like some of the Low Ki versus Bryan Danielson matches, they're not the same. Like, they're either too far in one direction or the other, you know what I mean?
And plus, Battle Arts would have different types. I mean, the Road Warriors were Battle Arts.
Right. And
in 1998!
And they always sent guys back and forth with Michinoku Pro.
Yeah, they were a cool group. So I definitely, everybody, if you haven't checked out Battle Arts, go find some Battle Arts somewhere.
Is there any online?
I'm pretty sure YouTube has some.
And also, and I do want to give a Takeshi Ono shout out too.
And Muhammad Yone
too. Yeah. Ono, I feel like was the guy who was underrated for a long time.
Oh, then, totally. Yeah.
And then kind of everyone realized just how great he was like right before he disappeared.
Carl Malenko, we can't not mention him either. So
AKA Carl Greco, AKA Carl Contini, AKA Carl Agnabini, or whatever his real name is.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Great wrestler, yeah.
Go check out Battle Arts.
The one last thing I want to mention, because he was also in New Japan, Boss Rutten's Battle Arts matches. Everything Boss Rutten did in pro wrestling, but including his Battle Arts stuff, like against Carl Malenko.
Yes.
So now moving to everything Battle Arts, and a certain tape dealer in Western Pennsylvania also has a great Battle Arts set. I think some other people have it too online. Like if someone wants to get it online, I guess IVP Videos has it. I think.
Yes. Yeah. Check out IVP Videos for sure on stuff like that. They're probably the best bet.
Yes.
All right. Moving on to a completely different type of Japanese organization, Go Gundam.
Oh,
Ryuma Go's little group. Billy Jack Haynes missed the two cards for Ryuma Go this past week and was replaced by Dane Rush. Now, Dave believes that Haynes suffered a concussion in a match in Vancouver, Washington the week earlier. Now, Go and Koji Katao beat Bruiser Brian Cox? Bruiser Brian Cox and Rush on January 16th at Cork and Hall before 1,500 fans. So, a healthy house. And then on January 18th in Osaka before 250 fans, not a healthy house, Go and Jesse Barr kept the CWUSA tag titles, beating Rush and Brian.
What a selection of human beings here.
We've talked about this on the past, how in one of these shows where Ryuma Go and NOW would use like the Northwest guys, you know, on shows.
But they had still, Billy Jack Haynes and Ryuma Go. Look at the lives that those two men have had, the stories they could share.
Well, I don't think Billy Jack Haynes did gay sex for money.
No.
I don't think he did. But
I don't think he ever stole a woman's purse either, that we know of.
No. But Billy Jack Haynes has had some questionable actions outside the ring, but wow. Interesting stuff there. Now, IWA Japan, this is quite the headline here. Further bad news for Americans looking for work in Japan is the apparent lack of interest of IWA in booking foreign talent. It has been rumored since the final tour in 1995 that IWA would cut back on foreigners and that Booker Victor Quiñones would be leaving, and he did the week after this, what we're talking about. Now, on the February tour, they won't be having any foreigners, and the fact that Cactus Jack and the Headhunters are both looking for full-time work in the United States seems to be a second indication that this may be a permanent deal. The owners of the group think they can feud Tarzan Goto with ancient Japanese names like Great Kabuki and Umanoseki Ueda and save the transportation costs of flying Americans over and still draw just as well. Now, the Hunters did lots of jobs on the current tour, which ended on January 15th in Yamato near Tokyo. And on that show, Goto and Mr. Ganosuke kept the NWA tag belts. That's weird. Beating Taijit Singh and Ueda, which was a legendary team in the late 70s and early 80s. They did a major angle after the match where Ueda and Goto brawl backstage, and Ueda pulled a knife on Goto. Goto left but came back with a four. And they basically carved each other up to set up a match in February 5th in Chiba, which would be a knife versus fork match, where Dave guesses the winner gets possession of a spoon as well, and they can sit down to a nice dinner.
All I know is that puts a whole spin on what you bring to a knife fight. I never would bring a fork, but hey.
Yeah. Now, the feud actually began on January 2nd at Cork and Hall when Singh and Ueda both attacked Tarzan Goto's wife, Despina Goto, former American woman wrestler, Despina Montagas. And the main event on the January 15th show was Cactus Jack and Shoji Nakamaki from Stranglemania fame versus Great Kabuki and Daikokubo Benkei in a broken glass match, and wound up with Goto breaking glass over Benkei's head and a juice, leading the Kabuki challenge into a singles match on February 2nd at Cork and Hall. Ueda managed Singh the entire recent tour, but the 55-year-old Ueda only worked the final night in the ring. Pete, this is a lot of old Japanese men here.
It is.
IWA Japan, though, we talked about this on the show, had a big following in this time period among the tape trading community because of their crazy matches.
It wasn't one of my groups because I was never into the blood and guts of weapons for sake of weapons. But, I mean, Cactus Jack made a total reputation here. The Headhunters, I always love it because, I mean, it seems like they were reported for years going somewhere in the United States, and I don't think they ever really
even
were.
This week. Yeah. What are you talking about?
It's IWA is so it's just amazing, and the Great Kabuki stunk in 1983, so in 1996, I mean he was just on the Tokyo Dome show, for crying out loud, for New Japan. Amazing. It's just amazing. And a knife and fork match, what the hell. I mean, what can you do? I mean, what did you guys ever see this knife and fork match?
I don't remember seeing it. No,
I don't remember seeing any IWA between 1996 and 2000.
Yeah, I didn't.
Were there even any tapes around?
Yeah, it was some, but it was something I wasn't actively looking for. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
IWA I saw originally was on the Stranglemania tape that ICP put out. Which is awesome, by the way.
I like
for their commentary.
Yeah, I like Kabuki in the 2001 IWA that I've seen. He still had the Kabuki uppercut.
Okay.
Yeah.
But he could sort of rely on that, which he can't now. But this is kind of the end of a very short era. Maybe not that short, because this is kind of the end of your secondary deathmatch promotions. Like, you know, and the kind of the crew they shared as far as Wing and IWA, like even when Big Japan started to get more of a presence, I think they had already opened, they took their place in the pecking order, but all the guys who were there either went to FMW or just didn't come back.
FMW was on another level from everybody else. That's just one aspect of what it was. Yeah. They were running stadium shows, so they were what they were.
Well, IWA ran a stadium show.
They had that one, but that was like, you know, their one shining moment.
Well, with hindsight, I can't even believe that show drew. You know what I mean?
Terry Funk. I mean, it was a lot of people on that show.
But it's not like IWA drew even decently well for their other shows.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. It's like, they didn't, did they draw 2,000 people that with any regularity?
They would sell out Korakuen, but that's about it.
Outside of Korakuen, yeah.
No, that's no, what, not
that's,
regular.
That's kind of my point. Like that they, I mean, they didn't pack Kawasaki Stadium, but they drew like 30,000, maybe less. You know, I'm guessing it was kind of a work number, but still.
Yeah. Now, speaking of drawing houses, Michinoku Pro drew 5,070 fans in Sapporo on January 17th for a Street Fight main event as Giant Zebra. Excuse me, a character from the original Tiger. I'm sorry. A character from the original Tiger Mask cartoon series in the comic book and cartoon, Giant Zebra was actually Giant Baba. But in this case, it's Kenji Takano, and Great Sasuke beat Mr. Pogo and Grand Naniwa. Now, some of the Michinoku Pros will change their ring names on the next tour, as Sato will now be known as Dick Togo, Terry Boy will now be known as Men's Teo, and Shiru will now be known as Tokyo Jin.
That last one didn't happen.
That last one did not happen.
Three stuck, yeah.
But, yeah, those first two now. of course, this is the beginning of the Kayentai DX run.
Which is the golden era of Michinoku.
This is the golden era of Michinoku Pro. And, Michinoku Pro in 1996 and going 1997 was some of the most fun wrestling around. Just great high-flying matches. You know, they had the group of heels, but they could mix in a rotating cast of baby faces to go against them, and just classic stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it was high flying mixed with a little lucha. You had great Sasuke, who, I mean, say what you want about him, he was an incredible high flyer. You had the heels, the Kayentai. Eventually, you see Taka Michinoku come in. I mean, it was just a really fun promotion. I mean, they bring in some I think, who was it? I'm drawing a blank on the British wrestler. Johnny Saint. I mean, how cool is that? Be able to come into Japan and you do a Johnny Saint match with the Michinoku Pro guys. And it was not only did they do that, but they also bring in other talent, and they have these like meshing pools of stuff of just Nirvana. It was kind of like, if you're a fan of wrestling and you couldn't enjoy a Michinoku Pro show, it was kind of sad, because they had a little bit of everything, from high flying to some brawling. But I mean it was basically, most people knew it for their high flying, but they did a lot of the other styles that they'd have showcase on their shows and stuff.
They're almost like battle art. Well, I mean, but battle arts, which was not a sister promotion but almost as good as one. Like, but instead of being based in, shoot style, they were based in kind of the Japanese junior style with a little lucha, but still other guys could be plugged into that. Like, whether it's lucha guys or Johnny Saint or Danny Collins or people like that.
Yeah, and they would, they had guys like Jinsei Shinzaki, who, was a bigger guy, and, they had their comedy stuff with, the Genjins and all that stuff. And it was a total, mixed bag of stuff.
Yes.
It was always entertaining shows. So, yeah, Michinoku Pro, like I said, they ran, they had the These Days show in October of this year, which was a huge show. They did a very strong House of Sumo Hall. They may have sold it out, So they, I guess you could say Michinoku Pro in 96 had kind of like it was nowhere near the style, but like a DDT type buzz right now, maybe.
Kind of, I would say, yeah.
So
they could run the big buildings for big shows, in this time period.
Right. And so. the whole Kayentai DX change is really the beginning of like the Michinoku Pro that everyone kind of remembers. Because before this, it's more hit or miss than I think than most people like to admit.
Yeah.
A lot of like very patterned matches, a lot of like, not that I dislike lucha comedy or anything like that, but it was very samey. It seemed like they were always doing the same match, and it was anything that kind of deviated from the norm with the main event, with the, trying to remember what was the, before they realigned everyone around this time, I'm trying to remember. So what was it? It was Sasuke, Sato, and who's the babyface team? Sasuke,
Delphin,
No, Delphin was the heel. Was a heel.
That's right. That's right. Delphin was the heel. That's right. Yeah.
So I think it was Sato, and Sato feuded with Delphin. So I'm guessing Sato was. It was Sasuke. Like I'm thinking, what's the weekly pro show? Who is it? It's Sasuke.
Yeah, Naniwa was on there.
It's Delphin, Naniwa, and
Grand Hamada.
Yeah, I can't remember the teams before they switched around.
Yakusuji.
Yeah, and then once it becomes, you know, Kai and Tai DX with also Taka Michinoku and Shuichi Funaki, the Dream Chasers being added to the existing Kai and Tai lineup with the name changes, and Sasuke forming his, you know, Sasuke Seikigun stable with all the baby faces, that's when everything just kind of turns around, and that's when they really started picking up momentum in the ring, and I feel like in terms of buzz. Because, you know, Sasuke had been in and out of New Japan for a couple of years. But, well, I think, you know what? Him also picking up the IWGP Junior title around this time helped, too.
Yeah. And without this era of, you know, Michinoku Pro, you know, Toriumon is not nearly, you know, Toriumon took a lot of this stuff, too.
And, you know, without Michinoku Pro, though, you also don't have a place for the Ultimo students to really get, you know, settled in Japan.
Exactly. That's where they were before Toriumon, you know, started back up. So,
right. But this
started up completely in 99. Yeah. If you go 98, you'll see all the, you know, Crazy Max guys and you know, the regular army guys in Michinoku Pro when Michinoku Pro restarted back up again.
Yep.
After their hiatus, and I mean, really was a, you know, breath of fresh air for that product. Yeah. No doubt they have all the new blood in there because they lost everybody, all their heels to WWF.
Right.
You know, so
I'll say, and then we'll move on. Anyone who just has not seen a lot of Michinoku Pro from that era, you'll either see it by one of two names. It's either the actual name of the tape was Heartbreak, or you'll see it referred to as just Michinoku Pro, September to December 96, which is a home video that they put out. If you want to get hooked on Michinoku Pro, that's the tape to watch.
Yes. Yes. Fantastic matches all across the board. Lots of great multi-man matches on there. And moving on to war, Tenryu Genichiro issued a challenge to Nobuhiko Takada for the IWGP heavyweight title. Tenryu said he is only going to wrestle about 20 times in 1996 as he turns 46 this year and is hurting and picking his spots. That's the main reason the company is being built around Hiromichi Fuyuki as a top guy rather than Tenryu.
Mm.
Funny reading this story in 1996. Big, I mean, Tenryu, you know, guy, he went 19 years, you know, more.
I mean, he had really slowed down a few years ago, but yeah. And then has one of his career years in 2001.
Well, 98, he had a fantastic
and 98, year. Too. Yeah, I mean, that's maybe even almost kind of underrating the war stuff a little bit. Because he had really amazing runs on a big stage when he started working with more regularly for New Japan and then All Japan and all that.
Yeah, now Pete, do you think Fuyuki was the right choice as being like the guy to build a company around at this time period?
I'm not sure. I don't know who I would have picked, but I really thought he lacked some charisma to be the top guy. Man, I'm just trying to think because I was trying to watch Ultimo Dragon back in the day.
Well, see, that's the one I would have shifted War into more of a. I mean, yeah, you got your heavyweights there, but the focus more on Ultimo Dragon because he was a guy that had the buzz.
He had the buzz. You had Jericho working there. I mean, even Gato and Jado had a slight buzz about him, too. They could have definitely gone into a more junior heavyweight direction and stuff instead of what they did. But, I mean, but it ended up being Tenryu still was around forever. So, did it really matter?
No, it didn't matter.
And Fuyuki was really underrated around this time. And even, you know... I don't think he got the credit he deserved for still being a good worker until the FMW stuff a couple years later.
Yeah.
But I just don't think he's the right guy either. But I'm not sure, like, maybe...
Who was, as far as the heavyweights, yeah.
Yeah, like, maybe you make a deal with New Japan to get someone to come in on full-time on their tours. Like,
yeah. I mean, it was around this time that war was looking like, you know, it's about time to absolve and, you know, do something else, you know.
Yeah, replacing Tenryu is just a tough, tough thing to do. I mean, that's like, I mean, he's like an icon. Like, you have, like, Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair. I mean, Tenryu was in that.
Yeah.
Except, I mean, I just can't even imagine having to try. Because, I mean, War was a good, cool promotion. But it wasn't a deep promotion. So, I don't know.
Yeah. Now, Koji Shinriki, who we talked about last week, a popular former sumo wrestler who worked for a few years as a pro wrestler, mainly for the old SWS before getting married to a woman wrestler and both retiring from wrestling, will return for Takashi Ishikawa's Tokyo Pro Wrestling on March 22nd. Ishinriki, now 34, and former LLPW wrestler Utako Uzumi, who was pushed as kind of a sex symbol type in LLPW, have been running a snack bar business since leaving wrestling.
Now, what exactly does running a snack bar business mean?
Well, it's funny how we get these wrestlers in Japan who get involved in the restaurant business. You know,
yes.
Toshiaki Kawada, yeah, with his ramen, and there's other ones who I can't remember off the top of my head. But, yeah, and of course in Mexico it happens a lot.
Like, so I got Abdullah here. I mean,
you have Abdullah here. You know, Ultimo Guerrero is Mr. Burger in Mexico. And
how did I not know about Mr. Burger?
Yeah, he's Mr. Burger. He's got his own hamburger joint. And then, you know, Shocker has restaurants. Super Astro, of course, with the torta.
The Super,
you know,
Torta.
The Super Torta. So, I don't know. Wrestling and restaurants is kind of go hand in hand. But, yeah, Ishinriki, not a very good wrestler.
No. Oh, Shinji Sasazaki with a sushi restaurant in Nashville.
That's right, yeah. So, yeah. I just thought that was interesting. That
Ilio DiPaolo.
Yeah.
That not he Japanese, got, but
it is interesting that he got two straight weeks on Between the Sheets. But on
that note, the only time that will ever happen.
Yes. On that note, we're going to take a quick break and let the Place to Be boys pay the bills and advertise all of our shows we have on here. And when we come back, AAA, we're going to Mexico, and AAA and Televisa's war ends. We'll be right back after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation, placetobenation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and placetobenation.com. You can check out myself and Scott Criscolo on The Mothership, The Place to Be Podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you there, including Main Events, which features a roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Shows, and Wrestling with Optimism, which focuses on the positives of the business. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past through Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave's Wrestling Culture podcast, our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance podcast starring myself and Pro Wrestling Only's Will, diving into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to dive into as well. We feature The Extra Point with Scott Criscolo and Dr. G, The Kings of Sport featuring Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, The Sports Sound hosted by Cowboy and Cowboy Sr., as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes a year-round deep dive into pro hoops. PTBN also proudly features Richard and the Mailman podcast, which specializes in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows are available on PlacetoBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN is also home to the tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats, RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net.
Do you watch pro wrestling? Do you love pro wrestling? We do too. And there's only one podcast feed that you can't miss.
PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network. That's the Pro Wrestling Only, Place to Be Nation, Podcast Network.
We have a host of brilliant shows dedicated to wrestling past and present.
Whether it's the territories, Japan, Lucha, old school or new school, we've got something for you.
Get a dose of history on Exile on Bad Street with Chris Zellner.
Listen to reviews of current pay-per-views on the PTBN reaction shows, not just WWE, but New Japan, Ring of Honor, and NXT. And get your weekly update on everything else that's going on in the indies, lucha, and beyond on This Week in Wrestling.
Relive WCW Supercards on Where the Big Boys Play with Parv and Chad.
Join Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave on one of the very best shows for super hardcore nerds, wrestling culture.
Go deep into WWF history and discover the Bob Backlund and Bruno Sammartino eras on Titans of Wrestling.
Don't miss the Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston.
You can get the full archive of Goodwill Wrestling with Good Old Will from Texas.
There's Tag Teams back again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze.
Then there's the only pro wrestling game show, Brainbuster, with me, Johnny Sorrow, and a panel of great guests every time.
Get them all on one feed.
PWOPTBN Podcast Network.
You know you want to hear it.
And we are back. And listen to all those great shows you have heard advertised on the Place to Be Nation Network. We're going to go to Mexico now and AAA. And the AAA Televisa split was resolved this past week, with Televisa both taping and televising the AAA show on January 12th in Neza and airing in the regular time slot on January 14th. In addition, on January 13th, Televisa aired a tape of the December 18th show from León that they had in the can for the past several weeks. Now, AAA had been on television the previous weekend when owner Antonio Peña and Televisa had a split up over Televisa's directive that all television tapings in 1996 take place in the Mexico City metropolitan area to save the company travel costs.
Yes, travel costs. There's that again.
Yeah.
We always, every time we hear about running outside of Mexico City, it's travel costs.
Yes. Peña felt that with AAA taping two shows every week in Mexico City, along with the two EMLL shows taped every week in Mexico City, it will destroy an already burned-out marketplace, both when it comes to attendance and fan heat, both which will result in a worse television product. During the week, Peña began negotiating with TV Azteca, Channel 13 Mexico City, which will be the equivalent of dropping from NBC to Fox, or maybe worse. Televisa aired a taped soccer game on January 6th in a three-hour block of EMLL, that was pretty much described as dreadful on January the 7th. When the weekend ratings came in, the AAA EMLL block on Saturday night did a 10 rating and is the fifth highest rated show the entire evening on all of Mexican television. Televisa called Peña during the week to put things back together, and the two sides agreed by the weekend that Televisa cameras were at the AAA show on January 12th, although terms of the new deal won't be talked about until this coming week.
Now, I know it's been 19 years, but isn't it weird to read now about seeing NBC for going from NBC to Fox as a downgrade?
Well, back then Fox was still seen as the, you know, the bastard child.
I know, but it's like we never thought it would get to the point that it's been like the last 10 years or so.
Oh no, yeah. Yeah, it's a different era.
Yeah, it really is.
Now, this left EML promoter Paco Alonso in the same situation that Peña was in just a few months ago. Alonso, sensing Peña was on the ropes, had a meeting of all of his wrestlers on January 12th, saying that anyone who worked Juan Herrera shows, dude, we talked about this guy before, which had formerly been affiliated with Alonso, but Herrera switched affiliation to Peña, would be through. And told the wrestlers that EMLL would be having 5 hours a week of television on Televisa, and that AAA was off forever. This is probably what he had been led to believe by Televisa. This was similar to how Peña was led to believe by Televisa, and told his wrestlers that EMLL was going to be off Televisa. Alonso told the wrestlers that without television, the AAA house show promoters would be switching over to EMLL. Thus, even though lots of wrestlers would be jumping over, the wrestlers would be getting enough bookings. The timing of this meeting couldn't have been worse, as AAA reappeared on Televisa the next night, which couldn't have helped him credibility-wise with his wrestlers. I'll say. I tell you, the politics in Lucha at this time period is crazy.
It's only going to get worse.
It's only going to get worse. And, you know, we talked about a lot of this stuff on and off these shows from this time period, and it's just always so intriguing. Now, several new angles at the first television show taped in 1996, which took place on January 12th in Neza before a sellout of 3,000, with another 2,000 turned away at the door for the second straight full house. They also had sold 3250 in Mexico City at Deportivo Oceana on January 13th for the second straight Saturday night sell in that building. The first television match from January 12th saw Los Cadetes de Espacio face Mr. Condor and Marabunta, along with Duende and UWA wrestlers Bronco and Rocky Santana. In the match, Condor had Thunderbird pinned when Marabunta ran in over eager and began kicking the hell out of Discovery, which caused a DQ. The two ended up arguing and brawling to break up their partnership, although it wasn't apparent which one was turning. Now, Bix, these are some great workers in this match.
Yes.
You know, the Space Cadets and Marabunta and Condor, two of the great Rudo bass wrestlers ever. I mean, that whole the Diabolicos group with Angel Matal. I mean, this is high-quality stuff right here.
I mean, they were still great Rudo basses for another decade at least.
Yes.
Remember their matches with, what was their name, Los Futbolistas?
You know, and then Los, you know, Los Barrio Boys, yeah. Alan, Billy Boy, Desnes.
It's Dennis. It's I thought it was just pronounced Dennis.
I know. I just love saying Desnes.
Oh, yes. Me too.
But it is D-E-C-N-I-S.
For trademark reasons.
Yes. But, yeah, this is just it's fun stuff. Now, next up was a Mexican tag team Mexican national tag titles match for the held up titles when Juventud Guerrero and Psicosis took on El Mexicano and Volador. Juventud and his father Fuerza had the titles, and of course, Fuerza has left to join Promel from Azteca and is no longer on speaking terms with his son since his son returned to AAA. Since Mexican national titles aren't owned by the promotion but are supposedly controlled by the commission, they had a hearing for Fuerza to explain why he wasn't going to be there for the title defense. Fuerza was actually booked on a show in Tijuana that night for Rey Mysterio Sr. and came to the hearing with Blue Panther, while Octagon, the leader of AAA's union, that's right, union, and Mascara Sagrada, AAA's programmer, a.k.a. Booker, were at the meeting representing AAA. At the meeting on the record, while an argument ensued between the two sides, Panther and Fuerza mentioned that it was Octagon's idea originally for them to form a new group and leave, and that Sagrada was with them. So why were they acting so bitter now at Fuerza and Panther for leaving? The meeting was a bitter blow for Antonio Pena, because while it was rumored that Octagon and Sagrada might leave, and that Octagon was with the Promel group but changed his mind, Pena never knew it for sure until this came out publicly. And it kind of broke his heart because Sagrada was the first gimmick he created when he was EML of Booker, and Octagon was the first superstar he created. Anyway, in the tag title match, which was said to be around 4.5 stars, Fuerza Juventud was pinned in the third fall, leaving Psicosis against both faces, which makes great sense psychologically if you think about it. And he pinned both of them. Psicosis did a moonsault off the top to the floor on Mexicano, and Psicosis destroyed Volador in the ring with a maneuver which caused him to be stretchered out.
That match is awesome.
It is very awesome. And real quick before we talk about the match, Bix, how about this press conference, huh?
Yeah.
And the reason why AAA had a wrestlers union, I mean, that's another thing, you know.
Well, that they had their own union, you mean? Or
yeah.
As
yeah,
opposed to the main wrestlers union. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he may have been like the representative, I guess you would say.
No, I think they were separate unions because there. Oh, I think there was a. Yeah. I think the Sindicato or whatever it was called was the EMLL and UWA union. There was a separate AAA union. No, I think that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Pete, this match, Juventud and Psicosis were just tremendous this time period.
And Big Fire.
This match was a great match. Was this match on the 1996 set that was on the that Will did?
I thought it was. I'm not 100% sure, but I thought it was.
I think so. And
but yeah, these guys are all fantastic, though.
I guess would you say that this is the last like really great match of Volador Sr. as Volador?
It's arguable, yes.
And like even I'm trying to think for Mexicano too. Like, how much did Mexicano do after this?
High profile wise, not really a whole lot.
So I mean, this is in a way you could say this is kind of his swan song on a major league level, at least. But and really for Volador especially, because this is the last time he really does like a high level, high flying match. Because didn't he blow out his knee either in this match or not long after? Within a few weeks, even?
If it wasn't this match, it was at that time period.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, some match. Now, also at the taping, you had the major angle. They were giving proclamations to Rey Mendoza and Blue Demon, who are two of the biggest legends in Mexican mat history. And something out of the United States playbook, but apparently that has never been done in Mexico, Petoff Jr., who was being pushed as the lead heel, ripped up the certificate and started shoving the 70-ish Demon. Now, Blue Demon Jr., who jumped earlier in the week, ran in to protect his father, but ended up getting destroyed. Later in the main event, after La Parca, Octagon, and Sagrada won by DQ over Petoff, the original Pentagon, and the Killer for excessive roughness, Demon Jr. attacked the Rudos, who destroyed him once again. Apparently, the heat in the building was incredible because disrespecting wrestling legends like Petoff did is something foreign to this wrestling world. I remember seeing this, and yes, it was a volcanic heat because it's something you just didn't do in Mexico. People do not remember. I mean, they know Petoff. They know, like, the current Petoff, you know, who sucks. But Petoff Jr., or, you know, of course he would drop the Jr. later on and become Petoff, was one of the best heels in Mexico in the decade. People just don't, they don't, I mean, he was not a great worker, Bix, but as a heel, as a Rudo, phenomenal.
He was a solid enough wrestler who had really good, like, heel timing and all that, and I think that even got better, even though his body broke down, I think, after he unmasked.
His mannerisms is what I thought I remember, just remember about him, because he could, you know, he could work in that six-man structure, but his mannerisms could just carry it so well because how over he was as a heel and stuff.
Yeah, I think he's a guy who could have maybe even been a bigger star if he had lost the mask earlier.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, he had a great look without the mask.
Yeah, he just looked like such a, like, villain. You know what I mean? With the way he had the facial hair and everything, just his, and it just his facial expression.
The laugh.
Yeah. Like, oh, yeah, if you just picture in your head a Rudo, he is like what would come into your head.
Yeah, he really does have that. He does have that Rudo face.
Yeah. And now, question I have, though, so Mascara Sagrada was the booker at this point? Not Conan and with Pena, or...
It's interesting when I saw that because I guess maybe it's because Conan is working with WCW a little bit, or ECW this time. He's doing ECW stuff.
But he's not full time with anyone.
But I guess, you know, his ambition was there. Let's put it that way.
Yes. And when did Sagrada leave?
The original?
Yeah.
I do not know the exact date.
Because I think Sagrada Jr. came in 96, and who wasn't his son, of course, but they were grooming him with it seeming like the original was out the door, I think.
Yeah, and then, you know, and then the second Mascara Sagrada is the guy that plays El Abrije or Cranio right now. He was Mascara Sagrada too.
And he was I'm trying to remember, was the Sagrada who was actually really good in the ring, was that the second one, or was there a third one?
Oh, there was multiples.
Because I remember there eventually, like, that was one who was, like, really good. And the joke was always just how much better he was than the original ever was.
All right, Sagrada left in 97.
Mm-hmm.
And he left because of the whole deal with the copyright to his name. He was... you know, wanting to have that copyright. And that battle went on for years.
Oh, God, that went at least 5 years, right?
Seven years.
Yeah.
2004, yeah. And he eventually won the rights back to his name in 2005. Yep. So, but yeah, he worked around. He would work as Mascara Sagrada Original, Mascara Sacra. So he was around, but he was a guy that, I mean, he basically couldn't do nothing for a while there. And he couldn't work in EMLL or AAA because of the whole thing situation with his name. But, yeah, interesting stuff. And Pete, you know, the Legends deal, I mean, that's a, like I said, it was a different time, different place. You could get away with that. Now, you really couldn't get away with it. It wouldn't work as much.
No, yeah, because it's just it's been more exposed. But yeah, back then, I mean, in '96, I mean, the legends in Mexico were protected. I mean, they could work. I mean, they still work related to their careers, but I mean, people still always had fond memories because people were working into their 50s and 60s, and they'd finally start retiring, and not only were they legends, but they were fresh in their mind. And so when they did the disrespect angle, I mean, since they didn't do it often and actually not at all at that time frame, I didn't see it, but I mean, I can't imagine how heated it was and stuff. I mean, it had to have been explosive heat.
Yeah. Now, back to more politics, because getting enough of that. The Moreno family, which is Of course, Cynthia, Rossi, Esther, Oriental are leaving the EMLL fold along with Juan Herrera and helping AAA. A key deal to that is that Ultimo Dragon, who is part of the family through marriage, and he was at a combined show in Nakapan over the weekend, said he was finally quitting EMLL. Dragon said that he wouldn't be going to ECW because he's in too much pain to do what would be necessary to get over there. It's interesting. He's got so many injuries now at age 29 from all the craziness of his youth that he looks at wrestling as a business. It feels he could probably last one more year in Japan before he'll take it easy and work a toned-down style in Mexico. Now, Paul Heyman saw a tape of the July 7th Dragon vs. Chris Jericho match a year from Japan and was interested in bringing them in as a feud. Interesting, Bix. Of course, Chris Jericho would come in because of that match.
Yes.
But Ultimo and ECW, that and bringing them in as a pair, that would have been interesting.
Yes. And I'm trying to think, because you also got, I mean, Psicosis was done with ECW by that point, but you still had Ray and Hoovy.
Ray and Hoovy was starting their stuff up, yeah.
Although they would be, I'm trying to think, when did they finish up? March?
Was it March or April, yeah?
It was March. It was after March, because I think their last shows were the big-ass Extreme Bash shows, right?
Yeah, it was March 1st, 96, right?
Yeah.
Or was it March 22nd? It was one of those.
March 22nd, that's right, okay. Yeah.
I thought it was March 9th. It was March 8th and 9th, I think.
I kind of remember it in 22nd.
No, because they did the because the Tijuana match was on the 16th and was after that.
All right, hold on.
Don't ask me how I remember. I don't usually remember all these dates off the top of my head.
Yeah, I'm not very good with dates. Yeah, the Tijuana match was after that, but then I thought Ray worked like a tag match with Mikey Whipwreck or 911 or something.
No, it was a 911 against the Eliminators, but I think that was in January.
Okay.
March the 9th, 1996, the 2 out of 3 falls match. Here you go. Good job.
They had three really high-end matches with each other in 8 days.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. Where were we? How did we get up?
We were talking about
Dragon and Jericho.
So Dragon and Jericho, I don't know. I think maybe it helps Jericho. I just don't know if it's the right fit for ECW at that point. Just something about it, like, I just don't know. I mean, they had good matches, but I think it ended up helping Jericho that Jericho was not being used as like a junior heavyweight attraction guy in ECW when he came in.
Married to a guy in particular.
Right. Because realistically, that did kind of sort of hurt Eddie Guerrero because, like, granted, he wasn't actually there long, but Heyman waited way too long to really go away from the Malenko feud.
Well, that was the last match was them two together. I mean,
no, but I'm saying they kept
together. They were aligned together for the whole time, basically.
Well, that's my point being, they were against each other, you know, for 4 months, wrestling anyone else except in tags where they were still wrestling each other.
You know, Eddie had the match with Scorpio.
Other than the Scorpio match when he came in, and then the Scorpio match the night before their last match.
Yeah. Now, talking about this toned-down style, though, I guess you could say, he didn't do it in Mexico, but WCW, would you say that was a toned-down style for him?
He did less flying, but he was great.
Yeah.
I mean, he got really over, I mean, almost shockingly over in WCW, doing a much less flashy style than he was known for.
Yeah. They did a really good job of pushing him, too, by the way. So that's another whole story.
And people forget just how over he was as a babyface.
Oh, yeah. Totally. Yeah.
The one thing I always have been WCW, I always thought the Mike Tenay call of calling him Bruce Lee's last dragon, like he was the last trainee of Bruce Lee, a total bullshit. But I always thought that was like the coolest thing, you know? I don't know why, but I thought that was like just a neat touch. It made him even seem more special than a normal wrestler.
Wasn't that the gimmick in Mexico too?
Yeah. That's where Mike got it from. Yeah.
Then that, Tenay ripped it off for him then.
Yeah, well, he was a Lucha fan, so it makes sense.
Now, do you guys know on this on the Dragon Jericho match why Dragon didn't dress like Dragon for that match?
No, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. He was just wearing normal briefs and a mask, and it just totally doesn't look like Dragon. I was just curious.
I don't remember the story. I do not, so I can't say.
When you mentioned that match, though, yeah, it came into my mind. Like I remembered, you know. From the way Dean Rasmussen, I think it was Dean, used to talk about it. He would call it the tiny pants match.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of like when Liger sometimes will work without this, you know, top. It was
heavyweight Ultimo.
It was Black Ultimo, whatever you want to say. Call it, you know, like Black Liger. But moving on. The January 18th show in Tijuana before 3550 was highlighted by a psychotic, totally lacking in psychology match between Psicosis and Ultraman, where Ultraman captured the Mexican national welterweight title in about 23 minutes. Now listen to all this great action. In the first fall, Ultraman dropkicked Psicosis off the top from head to toe and legit blew out his elbow in the landing. That didn't stop him from then doing a second tope, this time turning the move into a leg lariat on the way out, which I've never seen before. Finally, after a superplex, he won the first fall with a moonsault. Ultraman did a third tope in the second fall, and Psicosis did a tope as well. Psicosis wound up bleeding from the mouth and went in the fall with a Dandina. In the third fall, the match got insane. Genghis Khan, not the original, began interfering, so Rey Mysterio Jr. did a Liger dive onto him. Rey only made his bad ankle worse as he was limping all over the place, with Dave saying the styles become so dangerous that guys blowing out their knees is something that now happens about four times per show. Psicosis went for yet another tope, but this time it was a tope into a swinging chair spot. Los Pandoleros then came out with tables and a ladder. They did several ladder spots, and finally Psicosis was supposed to moonsault off the top of a ladder outside the ring through a table. However, he landed short and got really pissed off. Instead of still in the mist, he got up furious and climbed back up the ladder and splashed on Ultraman through the table, still landing short because the problem was the table was too far from the ladder, but managed to break the table, taking the brunt of the fall on his knees. Of course, he's indestructible, so he got right up from that as well. Khan then destroyed Mysterio Jr. with chair shots. Conan did a run-in, clocking everyone with chairs. Amidst all this, Rey came off the ladder into a springboard plunge into all three Pandoleros. Conan then threw the ladder off the top rope onto all three, knocking them back down, and Rey did a running dive over the top with a full body splash onto all three, with the ladder being made into a sandwich, which must have done wonder for the rib cages of all involved. After trading brutal chair shots and ladder spots, Psicosis attempted to do a dive off the top rope onto a table set up in the guardrail with Ultraman on it. Ultraman moved, and the table didn't hold up. It had its legs destroyed but wasn't broken, so Psicosis missed the table and nearly killed himself on the guardrail. Ultraman went for a power drive, but Psicosis gave him a low blow. Then Psicosis went from the top rope to the Arabian face pressure with a chair, but Rey hit him with a chair, and he crushed himself. Ultraman did a really sloppy DDT on two chairs for the pin to a huge pop. After the match, Psicosis tried another tope on the Ultraman, who moved, and he crashed on the two chairs on the floor. After Ultraman issued a mask versus mask challenge, and Psicosis accepted, he then immediately collapsed and did a stretcher job. It was an amazing exhibition in taking legit punishment put on by Psicosis, like a Sabu take it to the next level, before a guy with the talent Psicosis has. It's sad to see him go totally overboard by doing a match consisting of nothing but dangerous spots, because inevitably it's going to shorten what has potential to be a great career. Wow. This match sounds insane. And if I'm not mistaken, Bix, wasn't this on those DVDs that came out a few years ago?
The ones with Conan and Larry Rivera, was it, doing commentary?
Yes. If I'm not mistaken, I know this next match we'll talk about was on there, but I think this match is on there too.
I feel like I've seen the Psicosis blown spot with the ladder.
But what I read here, I mean, folks, this is a title match, a national title match at that.
That's not how those were worked normally.
No, but this is Tijuana, and these type of things happen. But Pete,
I think we should mention for those who don't know who was booking Tijuana at this point and promoting, I believe.
Conan, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he was way in love with the ECW style at this point.
Well, he was working with ECW, so yeah, totally. But Pete, what do you think about Dave's thoughts about Psicosis and his career there?
You know, I was with Dave with him at this time. I thought Psicosis was I couldn't believe how under pushed he got in WCW, because when he had the opportunities, he always had great matches. We saw it in AAA with Rey Mysterio having match of the years and all those great six mans and even his matches with Hijo del Santo. He was a guy who didn't have to do all this legit stuff like Sabu. Psicosis was a good worker, and he could get over with just working a lucha match. And here, you know, I think I blame Conan for having him do all this stuff, and he just got caught up in, you know, trying to pop the crowd instead of doing it on work alone and stuff.
Well, I mean, it was kind of his gimmick, though. It wasn't like he didn't do any of that.
No, he did flying. I mean, even like you see in WCW, that I always thought in his debut match on Bash at the Beach when he does that back dive. I mean, that's just insane. The plancha on the back. I don't even know what to call the move.
The twisting somersault senton, but he does it to the floor off the top turnbuckle.
Nuts. I mean, he doesn't do a safe style, but he could get over. Because he was a good enough mat worker, but he did rely on big spots to get over and stuff.
Right, and WCW also had those William Regal matches. I mean, he never got enough credit for just how good he really was as an all-around worker.
Yeah, those Regal matches were great. He was Mysterio. He, for some reason, he never clicked with Dean Malenko, or I never saw him click.
Well, that's because Malenko wasn't that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Malenko knew how to call a Psicosis match. But yeah, I thought Psicosis, he had a guy who, I mean, he had that great match with Tajiri and ECW. I mean, the guy has had a ton of great matches through Mexico and throughout the world. I mean, and even his matches with Mysterio Jr. in War were pretty damn good in 96 and 97.
Yes, indeed. And interesting, because the next match that was on this show was a similar style match. Halloween beat Leon Negro in a mask versus mask match with Leon Negro and mask against Juan Gonzalez. And a funny little sub note, this guy would become Psicosis after Nicho went to WCW. This is Psicosis 2, or as he's now known in CMLO's, Ripper. So yeah, this is guy, Leon Negro. And half the world was involved in this one, including the Pandoleros again, bringing out the ladder and the still not broken but destroyed table. Conan and Ray were also involved, as well as women wrestlers Barbara Blaze and Lady Victoria, the latter of whom Halloween powerbombed in a second fall. Halloween juice like crazy, Muto style. However, his orange mask not being ripped at the top, the effect of the blood coming out literally had like a faucet was lost. This match built and had great heat at the end with all sorts of dives. The finish was supposed to be Halloween lighting the ropes on fire and doing a liger dive over the fire and through the table, but the table wasn't in good shape and wouldn't hold up for the spot. He decided against killing himself on the spot and instead did a safer splash off the apron through the table. He was supposed to blow fire out of his mouth like Pogo for the pin, but when he blew, there was no fire, so he couldn't use that as the finish. The guys panicked, and Halloween then pinned him with a power slam, which was anticlimactic after all the fire and objects. Halloween has turned into a very good worker. But Leon Negro isn't that good. But with all the gimmicks involved and the fact they worked their butts off with lots of high-risk spots, the crowd was on its feet most of the third fall. That's not it, folks. Those two matches, along with the Conan La Parca Octagon versus Pentagon, Petoff, and KGB, our good buddy Tom Howard match, were about 75% ECW and 25% Lucha Libre, as they did tons of unprotected brutal chair shots. And both KGB and Pedro Russo juice from Conan's chair shots. Conan did a clean job in the third ball for KGB's German suplex, which is interesting. The opener featured the pro debut of Japanese wrestler Ninja Shiraku. He was nowhere near being ready, and it was a match as bad as anything you see on the worst indie show, and considerably worse than Mabel versus Yokozuna, like in a negative 3.5-star range.
Wow.
Who did he become?
I really don't know. Now, real quick, let me do a correction here. A few shows ago, I talked about Perro Silva, and I, doing the show, got confused and was thinking about Perro Russo. And yes, there are two different people. And I thought, if I remember right, I said on the show that Perro Silva, I didn't like Perro Silva. I thought he sucked.
Yeah,
no, Perro Russo is the one that sucked. Perro Silva was really good. So correction on me on that one. But yeah, Ninja Shiraku Bix, I don't know who that is. I really can't think of any Japanese guys that was in Mexico at that time that would have been there in that character. But anyway, KGB, Tom Howard, interesting guy, Bix, as far as wrestling career.
No, not really.
Well, places that he went to, all the different places.
I guess, and then getting his WWE developmental deal and never actually working in a developmental promotion, and then kind of getting his career, like his last thing with 01 with the kind of Guile from Street Fighter gimmick.
And this match, which I'm talking about, a lot of this stuff is on the Desperados del Ring Volume 2 DVD.
Okay, yeah, Desperados del Ring, that's what it was.
All right, now, Pete, we see here with Conan, you definitely see the ECW influence. And God, Mexico today is full of promotions that do stuff like this. Do you think that's a detriment to Lucha Libre as an art form?
Yeah, for sure. This show sounds like it's just the extreme and the old Ole Anderson story of watching Mick Foley. You'd see the village with 10 people dead, and then go to the next village and the heads are all blown off, and there's 20 people, and it just loses its luster. And I think the style has creeped into a lot of lucha nowadays, and it really did. It really hurt it overall. And I'm more of the presentation of lucha than actual anything else. It's just it just doesn't feel like it should be there. Because classic lucha brawls didn't need all this weapons and going through tables. It was there based on heat and being able to throw great punches and blood. When you don't need it, why do you do it? That's just my take on it.
Yeah, but this was the rage, though, and it stopped for a while there. It wasn't as prevalent, but like 10 years later, when the Mexican guys started watching CZW and stuff like that, that's when it was reborn even more, and that's what we've got today. So, yeah, it's a bad trend. So, anyway, moving on to EMLL this time, and back to our good buddy Juan Herrera. Since Juan Herrera officially turned down the booking job, Mano Negro is the sole booker. It's said that anyone from this group who works a show for Herrera won't be allowed back, with the biggest names leaving appearing to be Los Destructores, Shu El Guerrero, MS Uno, and Blue Demon Jr., all of whom will wind up with AAA. Then Shu was scheduled in a Máscara contra Caballera match with Huracán Sevilla on January 14th at Arena Azteca Budokan in Neza. So there you go, Bix. Let the blackballing begin for Juan Herrera.
Yeah, and it's weird to see him kind of politically aligned with Pena, given that it was their heat that led to Pena leaving and starting AAA in the first place.
Wrestling makes strange bedfellows, as we've seen over the years. Now, I love this story. Vampiro got the lead role in an upcoming television soap opera, which stars Gloria Trevi, the leading female rock star in Mexico. Conan also has a role in the show. Oh, what a coincidence. There is talk they're going to give Vampiro a major push as a new soap heartthrob type. Which they did. And Bix, Vampiro was a big star though in television in Mexico. A huge star.
Yeah. Now, have any of these ever aired in the U.S., like on Univision or anything?
I didn't watch that type of stuff at the time, so I can't tell you. I do know that Marco Corleone's stuff, I think, has aired in the U.S.
Oh, it does. Okay, because I was thinking, the only of this stuff that I've ever seen on American TV was the was when Latina Lover was on the Mexican version of Dancing with the Stars. Because that, I remember, aired on, I forget if it was Univision or Galavision.
Univision.
Yeah. That's the only thing I remember, so it's like... Not much we can really say about it. I mean, I've seen that, and I've seen the tape of Conan dancing in the orange suit, but I don't think I've ever seen the soap operas.
Yeah.
I just was going to say of you, but then I realized you haven't. And you just said you haven't, so.
Yeah.
Moving on, Pete.
I'm a telenovas.
All right, question up. Vampiro, better actor or better wrestler?
A better bullshit artist. that's all I got. Yeah, he's full of crap. I terrible wrestler. I've never seen him act, so I can't go on that. But as a bullshit artist, he's pretty darn good. Has some great stories.
Oh yeah,
excellent kidnapping victim.
Oh yeah, totally. Inside the ring, the crowds were said to be marginally better than the horrible houses last week, with the major focus being on a push for Shocker. In the January 12th main event of Arena Coliseo, Shocker, Atlantis, and Hector Garza beat Emilio Charles Jr., Negro Casas, and Apollo Dantes, with Shocker scoring the third fall win. It appears they're building up for Casas defending his welterweight belt against Shocker. Yeah, this is the beginning of the Shocker push, which made sense because he was a good young star, had the mask up this time. And Shocker's a guy who... Bix, I don't think nearly gets enough love from this time period. I mean, everybody knows the greatness of Shocker in the 2000s, but he was really fun in the late 90s.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen that much from this period.
Technico Mass Shocker.
I'm thinking about later on, am I totally misremembering now? He was in one of the Roulette with De La Muerte, wasn't he?
The first one.
Okay. That's what I was thinking about. I couldn't remember if it was the first or the second. Okay, yes, it was the first one where he lost his mask. Yeah, and I remember being really impressed with his performance there. And then, the thing is, though, he was good then, but then he got even better without the mask.
Well, of course, yeah. But, he was really fun, though, as a masked undercard. Masked Technico Shocker.
Right. Oh, and he has one of the best performances in the famous Cibernetico match.
Exactly, yeah. And Pete, it's funny. We're talking about Negro Casas, 1996. We talk about 1986. Talk about 2006. Now we're in 2016. The guy is just 4 decades is a great worker.
Incredible. Yeah. Over at Pro Wrestling Only, they're doing that greatest wrestler ever poll. And I have him slotted easily in my top 5. He's just, incredible. The fact that he's been awesome for like 30 years. Says a lot. That's just scary to have that much. It is incredible performances and moments in your wrestling career. And what more can you say about the guy? He just has legendary feuds and matches, and he just has a textbook of what anybody going into the wrestling business. You dream to have the Negro Casas' career and stuff.
And now, Biz, we got a special treat for you this week as we have an MMA section. Yay! But we're actually not talking about a show in particular.
Well, we're talking about a show.
Yeah, a
not
show.
Not a card.
Yeah. As Extreme Fighting, one of the Ultimate Fighting clones, was the subject of the January 17th Phil Donahue show, which, coincidentally enough, was the same day that Donahue announced the end of his nearly 30-year run as a talk show host. Largely due to the falling ratings and the loss of his time slot in both the New York and San Francisco markets. To say the show was scary would be an understatement. And this, of course, is all Dave talking here. Donahue had John Peretti, the matchmaker for EFC, along with promoter Anthony Guccione, a crazy man from North Carolina named Boz Spitzer, fighters John Lewis and Igor Zinoviev, neither of whom did anything but demonstrate moves, and Dennis Bacco, the attorney general for the state of New York. Now, what was scary was seeing the top law enforcement official in the second largest state in the country talk about banning something that he had taken no time to learn about. Bacco didn't even know about matches ending via tapping out until he was on the air. Now, Donahue, unlike the 1992 Pro Wrestling Show, where he came in having largely done a lot of homework, also didn't know the subject at all. He came off as obnoxious and almost a caricature of his former self. Wow! Now, who would have thought that? Trying to make overblown points on both sides. Peretti, who was the obnoxious ESC voice on the pay-per-view, was the subdued voice of reason on this show. He did a credible job at explaining what EFC was about, although nobody in the audience or the other guests or opponents appeared all that interested in listening. Equally scary was a graphic on the screen saying that 500,000 people had ordered the last EFC pay-per-view. The actual number was closer to 60,000. If numbers are exaggerated to that much of a degree on this issue, imagine that it isn't unlikely that they are being exaggerated to a similar degree on other issues on this. And other news shows that we make our own decisions on a lot more important topics about. Interesting commentary there by Dave. When an audience member asks the fighters how much they earn for participating, which Dave says EFC's purses are far lower than either USC or WCC, and are kept secretive because they are so much lower, Guccione said it was an industry secret. There was no mention of USC, which is the prime group in this genre, during the show. However, when Guccione brought up the lack of injuries as compared with other sports, including high school football, Donahue scoffed it off in disbelief. Even though Guccione said it was a fact. At one point, when Spencer, who proposed banning the event, but also proposed banning football, hockey, and the Phil Donahue show, although he admitted not having seen the Donahue show in about 20 years, also mentioned he learned about tapping out the finish during the show. When Peretti, acting in disbelief, asked his opponents, didn't they even bother to watch the event? Spencer's response was that he had seen the advertising for it. Now, Bacco tried to defend his position of banning EFC while not going after boxing, but saying that there are boxing matches that don't end with knockouts and go the distance. And when Peretti said ditto for us, Donahue, almost acting as if he didn't believe it, said they claimed they have matches that go the distance. There were several ridiculous comparisons to pro wrestling in the segment. While Peretti showed the fighters demonstrating amateur wrestling maneuvers to lead to positioning for a finish and pointed out that these are moves you see in wrestling all the time, Donahue said how we're all familiar with these moves from wrestling, but Donahue thought he meant pro wrestling. Donahue later went on a tirade about how so many people pay to see pro wrestling, which everyone knows is fake. So imagine how much money people will pay to see what they know is real and where the blood and broken bones are real. Bix, this is quite the train wreck, isn't it?
Yeah, like, because I'm trying to think about, because I know I didn't see this, because as alluded to, it didn't air in New York. I'm trying to remember how long before this he had lost the New York slot, because I remember reading about this and not realizing Donahue was still on.
Yeah.
I want to say it would have been maybe the previous year.
Yeah, I thought that, you know, reading this, I thought Donahue went off like maybe 93 or so. I didn't think he stayed on this long.
Yeah, and the whole this is very typical of the stuff that happened with UFC in the media around the same time, too.
Oh, definitely. MMA was like the bad word.
Like, I don't think you had quite as much. Like, I don't know if I remember other ones that got to the point where it was like, you know, they can end by giving up or blah, blah, blah. And they were like, you're lying. I don't know if that happened with UFC like it did for EFC here, but it was about the same otherwise. It's amusing to see one of the opponents outright admitting that he hadn't seen their stuff. Which shouldn't have always happened. Like, I don't think it happened with like John McCain or anyone for UFC. But, I mean, this is kind of amazing and ridiculous and all that. And now, let's see. Do you know who's Anthony Guccione's father?
Bob Guccione, of course. The guy who founded Penthouse Magazine.
I forgot that was in – I thought it was Bob Guccione Jr. There is a Bob Guccione Jr., right?
He's
the one who did Gear, right?
Yes.
So,
this is the brother.
This is his brother, yes.
Oh, the Guccione's.
What an interesting family that is.
Yeah, Penthouse is class, folks. Penthouse is, you know, of course you have Playboy, but Penthouse is where you start to see that little bit extra. You know, it's not Hustler, but it's right there, you know, right in the middle of that, you know.
That extra
you start to get more gynecological in Penthouse.
But that X on the next year started to include some things that most people didn't want to see. I don't know if it was around this time or a little later.
Yeah, but... You know,
should I say?
Go ahead.
Urine?
Yes. Penthouse was all, I mean, yeah, Penthouse a magazine that Ric Flair would be a fan of, no doubt. And hey, Patty Mullen.
Yep.
Penthouse Pen of the Year. The Clash of the Champions. But
actually, for I don't know. So, well, so they kept it that way because I was thinking another, and they went with the times as far as Flair's preferences would go.
Well, they did, but of course, this is the '90s, so they were still
true.
Flair's edict was still in play in a lot of ways this time period. But yeah, Pete, this era, the media in MMA was just a total clown show. I mean, nobody knew how to take it. It was just ridiculous.
Oh yeah, I mean, the way they were talking about it, you're expecting like people coming in almost like in a like an old wrestling street brawl, like a Terry Gordy Bad Street match or something, because of we had everything totally confused. They never really pushed up the athleticism of these guys and their background. You never heard, oh, he was an Olympic alternate, or he almost made the Olympic team, or he was on the Olympic team.
Well, they're starting to at this point, and this is really when the change. This is like it was this period, like early '96, was when you really started to get a lot more high level wrestlers in.
Right. Yeah. They always painted the groups together with the same brush. There really wasn't separation on who was who and what was what.
Yeah. And, you know, guys like Tank Abbott and stuff like that were perfect for the media to use in their, you know, making their case, you know, against, you know, MMA. But and this is the this is the time period where we start seeing more of a professionalism starting to creep into it.
Right, and also the kind of darkly funny thing about it, in terms of like what would happen because of no gloves and all that, bare knuckle. You know, obviously there are more rules now that make things safer in terms of the techniques, but. The thing that the general public never understands is that bare knuckle is safer than gloves.
Yes. I agree with that.
That was part of what fueled the whole, you know, MMA is so much safer than boxing thing. Because at the time, you know, it was largely true. The one bad thing about that was that MMA fans kind of carried it over for years and years after the rules changed, which kind of was not great. But... it's like, that's the one thing that even though with boxing, with MMA, with any, you can never, you should be able to go to it, or at least give it as an option to have bare knuckle, but it's never going to happen because the public just not understand at all.
No way
that you're throwing less punches, that you have to throw the punches more strategically, that gloves protect your hands, they don't protect your head. I mean, look at in MMA, the whole thing, you get knocked out easier with the smaller gloves.
Yeah. Now, to a whole another different part of the MMA scene this time. UFC announcer Don the Dragon Wilson, not a former Exile and Backstreet guest and Wildside announcer Dan the Dragon Wilson, a former the multi-time world champion in kickboxing and considered in his prime as one of the best kickboxers and now a video action movie star, regardless of weight in the world in some circles, had spoken to Ken Shamrock about training with him to prepare for an upcoming UFC, although nothing is definite on that. Now, Bix, real quick, better actor, Don the Dragon Wilson or Vampiro?
You know, I'm not sure if I've. I'm trying to think if I've seen any Don Wilson's movies, because I don't think I've seen the Vampiro movie. Have you?
I've seen clips of Vampiro's acting more.
Okay, how was it?
Not as good as the wrestling.
And have you seen any of the...
But it was effective.
Almost saying Dan Wilson. Have you seen any of the Don Wilson movies?
Yes, Don Wilson was on, I think, a couple of Cinemax movies back in the day, in the 90s. Back when Cinemax... back when it was different, though. I mean, there were movies that they would air that, you know, you would have, like, tits in it, but that was all you would get. It was like this subgenre of movies where the same group of actresses in it. I can't remember. I think Andy Sedaris directed the films. Andy Sedaris was a guy.
Oh, you're like your action thriller, like your Bagwell did some Andy Sedaris movies too, right?
Yeah, and Andy Sedaris,
like Shannon Tweed would be in it or something.
Kinda, yeah.
Or the girl from Dallas who played JR's mistress. I think I saw her in one of Dan Wilson.
But yeah, I mean, there was a rotating group of actresses. I can't remember all their names, but yeah, Don Wilson was in movies like that. God, I'm making a mistake too. Anyway, Andy Sedaris will.
You guys gonna get a cease and desist?
Yeah, Andy Sedaris is a guy. That's an interesting man. I know I'm getting sidetracked here, but it blows my mind. I mean, this guy went from being the number one guy at ABC as far as directing on college football and other sports. He did Olympics and everything. And then went from that to doing these type of movies.
He's like the Russ Meyer of action movies.
Yeah, the thing about Andy Sedaris was if you watch, though, the old games from the 60s and 70s that he directed, a lot of time was always spent in going to the crowd to show the hot girls. So once you knew about what his future was, it made sense. And Andy Sedaris was known for what, and this was mentioned on the air by Chris Schenkel, the legendary play-by-play guy, that Andy Sedaris was the guy who created the, quote, honey shot, unquote. They would openly talk about this on the air. It's a different era, folks. At college football games, here's the honey shot.
Now, wait a second. Does he have anything to do with what is referred to as the ESPN sex tape?
No.
You know what I'm talking about, though, right?
Yeah, this is way later than that. This is, yeah, the ESPN deal is way later. Andy Sedaris was gone from ABC in the 80s.
Okay.
That's when he started doing the movies. But yeah, Andy Sedaris is just an interesting guy to follow. But
if you want to laugh and be horrified, I think it's a Deadspin. Go out, look up ESPN sex tape. Have you ever seen that?
I have.
Chris?
I have. I know of it, but I haven't seen it.
It's online. It's not. It's most of it is not as explicit as it sounds, but it's still hilarious.
Please tell me, is Chris Berman in it?
No, it's it's like crowd shots.
Okay,
of like people either making out or having sex in the crowd at games.
That sounds funny.
And people in the control room laughing. It's interesting.
It's funny you talk about sex tapes because we're going to ECW, and this week on television is the angle where Beulah turned on Raven and revealing that she was pregnant with Tommy Dreamer's baby. And of course, Beulah had her run. And was it? Did she do the photo shoot with Penthouse or Hustler?
I don't know.
I thought it was Hustler.
One of those.
She was a pet. She was a pet. I thought.
Maybe. There you go. Tie in with Bob Guccione. So perfect tie in from that last segment. But anyway,
well, there was more than that, though.
Yeah. Now back to ECW proper. This is an interesting story. There may be attempts in New York to work the fans in the negative chance toward Philadelphia in a way to build up a New York versus Philadelphia feud similar to what they attempted earlier in the year with Philadelphia versus Florida. Now, Bix, you're a New Yorker. New York and Philadelphia have always had a feud in sports, the fan bases. Do you think that it was a smart idea for Heyman to try to do this, or do you think that it was kind of stupid?
I guess you could say, I was going to say that maybe you could say that it would maybe discourage some people who would come in from bus trips or whatever, but no, they'd probably want to maybe even root against the Philly. I don't know if it really makes a difference. I mean, he certainly riled them up. He was successful in doing what he was trying to do, for the rest of the company's existence, at least when they were taping TV at the Elks Lodge and stuff, they had that.
Yeah, that was later. This is Battalion Hall era, right?
No, I know, but I'm saying that, I mean, it worked. I mean, maybe it, I don't know if it was necessarily a thing till the Elks Lodge era, though.
Yeah. And Pete, what do you think about that idea of doing something like that? Do you think that independent groups today should be trying to do that or whatever?
I don't think they should be trying to do it, but I think Heyman, he was trying to create an atmosphere that ECW was this rebel group And, you know, and their fans are rebels, too. I think that's what he was trying to go for. I think he was trying to go for this, like, almost Roman gladiator feel of and when the fans are turning against each other, New York's trying to outdo Philly and do negative chants towards Philly and vice versa. I think he was trying to create a special atmosphere that made his product stand out differently than, say, WCW or WWF at the time. So, did it help heat for the actual matches? I don't think so, but it just, I think it started with it's where they started doing the you know, the chants we have nowadays and stuff, and then wrestling.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, right now we have, you know, with all the NXT stuff and the Full Sail sucks and the Brooklyn sucks and I think we can agree has not helped the heat for the actual matches.
Well, yeah. I mean, it is what it is. I mean, it's just what it, I mean, it's what it is. But, you know, it's not directed at the wrestlers themselves. It's, you know, I mean, that's them trying to get over, you know, doing
that's
it that
way. That's what I'm saying, yes.
Yeah. I mean, that like I said, that's it, if it doesn't affect the match, then yeah, I agree. I agree with you on that. Now, moving on to Between the Sheets' favorite, Paul Heyman was threatening to sue WCW over a hotline message where Terry Taylor said the ECW champion was a drug addict. Taylor issued what he said was an apology about calling the ECW world champion, not mentioning Sandman by name, a drug addict. The next week, he came back saying it's all characterizations, and he was talking about the wrestling character and not the person. Taylor also said in the 900 line that, quote, Sabu is a car crash waiting to happen, and once you've seen him, unquote. Now, Biggs, you know, Terry Taylor is one of your all-time favorites as far outside the ring.
Great work.
Yeah, great worker, but, you know, not the best of people outside the ring. What are your thoughts on his comments here about Sandman and Sabu?
Maybe he thought it was the Sandman from Showtime at the Apollo.
Well, he liked his gimmick of sweeping black people off the stage.
I feel like I'd have to hear exactly what he said to know if he was bullshitting after or not. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's a really, you know, nasty thing to say if, you know, if he was actually talking about James Hollington. That said,
which at this time of the Sandman's character, the beer drinking wasn't as prevalent. It was more about the cigarettes.
Well, he was kind of in between at this point. It was really neither.
Well, he was doing both.
Well, but he had kind of outgrown the smoking, and he wasn't that heavy into the beer drinking yet.
Yeah.
It was kind of, I feel like it was when Missy came in that they really ramped the beer drinking back up.
Yeah.
So that's like a month and a half away?
Yeah. But, Pete, what are your thoughts about the Sabu comments? Once you've seen him, you've seen him.
I mean,
do you think that's right on the money, or do you think he was off base?
I think he's off base. I mean, Sabu was someone at the time was special. He had a connection to the crowd, and I mean, some of the stuff he did was, you know, we've seen it once. Yeah, okay, yeah, we've seen him go through a table, but he always had a way of incorporating him into his matches where they stood out, and he, I mean, sometimes he was hit or miss, but I think Terry Taylor's off the mark by saying you've seen him once, you've seen him. That's all the time you need to really see him. I mean, he's a. I don't think he's a great worker, but I thought he was a memorable worker and somebody who was special, especially in between 94 and 96, really special.
Yeah, and this is like the. I probably said the last year that you could say that for Sabu.
Yeah.
Yeah, once he became a full regular in ECW, you know, it kind of changed because you saw him a lot more then than you were seeing him before, because he was bouncing around place to place.
Yeah, because he didn't really have his other indie dates as much. He didn't have Japan as much after.
So, yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
You're seeing him too much. He's getting overexposed.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't happen yet.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. 1960 was, I would say after 96. I would say probably after Barely Legal is when it started to change. And then they turned him.
You could even argue 96 is his best in-ring year.
Very arguable, yeah. I think there's a lot to that. Yeah, totally. Matt Scorpio match is one match that's definitely one of his best matches ever, I thought. Now, now we're going to USWA, and once I saw that this happened this week, it clinched this week for me for doing the show.
This might be the last great angle in the USWA.
This is one of my favorite television shows of USWA in the 90s because it has so much great stuff on it. On the January 14th television show in Memphis, PG-13 won the tag titles from Tommy Rich and Doug Gilbert. And Rich came back and beat Jerry Lawler for the USWA heavyweight title. Now, in the process of all this, of course, that's the unified heavyweight title. Excuse me.
The USWA heavyweight title is the Southern title. The unified title is called the unified title.
And in fact, this was the USWA title. That's right, because I think Jeff Jarrett was unified champion. So, yes, right, yeah. In the process of all this, Slashinger turned babyface. Tex Slashinger turned babyface. And Rich and Gilbert went heel, managed by Scott Bowden, my man, leading to the January 16th Memphis show, which was back the Monday night, because the Mid-South Coliseum had prior booking on Wednesday, having Lawler Slashinger headlining, beating Rich and Gilbert. I mean, headlining against Rich and Gilbert. The TV show, Dave said, was the best in several weeks, I'll say. Now, here's how it started. It started off with Rich and Gilbert defending the USWA tag titles against PG-13. It was a babyface match, but they worked aggressively because they had a pass. And the finish saw Gilbert come off top rope with a chain, but Wolfie D moved and ended up hitting Rich, who was pinned for the fall. Rich and Gilbert argued after, but ended up patching things up. Here comes Scott Bowden at Slashinger for an interview, holding both the old Southern heavyweight title belt and the USWA title belt, which they stole after Lawler won the match on January 10th. Yeah, they brought that old Southern title that from the 70s.
Okay, and I think reading this, I think Dave is saying USWA title when he means unified title.
Yeah, whatever, whichever one it was. But Bowden was running off his mouth about possession being 9/10 of the law when Slashinger told him to stop it. Slashinger called Lawler out and gave him both belts. Bowden went crazy and fired him. But he said that he quit and then pulled Bowden's pants down. Slashinger at first couldn't get him down, so he pulled harder and wound up pulling too hard because he got his underwear as well. Bowden fell on his stomach with his shirt covered, his butt on the floor, and then pulled his underwear up while on his stomach. Then came a battle royal, with the winner to get a title shot at Lawler on the same show, with Rich winning the battle royal, throwing out Jesse James Armstrong. During the match, Gilbert interfered and hit Lawler with a chain, which Rich, quote, didn't see, and Rich pinned Lawler to win the title. Now, more on that in a minute. Andrea Calloway showed up on television back as the manager of the Rock and Roll Express. Andrea is Ricky Morton's girlfriend, who was in the middle of the mess that got Morton fired from Smoky Mountain over the summer when Andrea pressed charges against both Tracy Smothers and his fiance Angela Lambert when Lambert allegedly beat her up. Dave believes the end result was that Calloway dropped all legal and civil charges against both Smothers and Lambert. In exchange, Lambert paid Calloway's medical bills from that fight. Then came a pretty hot scenario involving Lawler, Gilbert, and Rich. Lawler got hot at Gilbert for costing the USWA title, but Gilbert blamed Lawler for costing the tag titles, which Lawler had nothing to do with. Lawler couldn't understand what he was talking about, and Gilbert then said how mad he was at Lawler because Lawler would never do anything for anyone. And said he was so mad at Lawler from what he found out the night before that he lost the tag titles earlier that day. The storyline is that Gilbert talked about them doing a memorial show for Eddie Gilbert on February 3rd in Philadelphia and had Lawler turned down doing the show. In actuality, Lawler will be appearing on the show. Gilbert said that Lawler had forgotten everything and what Eddie and Doug had done for him. Lawler said the problem is that the promoter's show is Dennis Coraluzzo, who he called a shyster, who came to Memphis claiming that Lawler had two illegitimate children in Philadelphia, one of whom was Fred the Elephant Boy from Howard Stern in an angle several years back. Lawler then said he remembered everything Eddie and Doug had done to him and brought up several angles over the years, most of them when Eddie smashed up his car windshield with a baseball bat and when Eddie ran him over with a car and mentioned how Doug was in the car when that happened and said he wouldn't do a memorial show for Eddie anyway. Rich then came out and said if it wasn't for people like himself and Eddie Gilbert, that Lawler wouldn't even still be around. Lawler then brought 1987 angle where Rich hit on the ring, costing the hair match against Austin Idol. And now Rich and Idol posted this crotch later that year. Lawler then walked off and both jumped him. Bowden then came back out with an interview saying how glad he was that Rich and Gilbert had regained their killer instinct and called out Slashinger making a 3-on-1 beating, but naturally Lawler ended up making the save. This was a hell of a television show, folks. And me reading that doesn't do it justice.
I know the Doug Gilbert angle's on YouTube, and it's fantastic.
Yeah. Because it kind of comes out of nowhere, considering, because Rich and Gilbert were baby faces, were part of the feud against Smoky Mountain and all this other stuff, which they're starting to phase that out here. And yeah, this is the new beginning of a top heel deal where they made Bowden, Rich, and Gilbert the top heels again, feeding with PG-13 and feeding with Lawler and Seth Slasinger, and they're starting to do some new things. But Pete, I don't know how much USWF in this era you've watched, but I mean, this is the end of that great era of USWA.
I remember, I think I have the show on disc at home. I mean, I'm at home. And I remember it just being wild from beginning to end. The angles and the action in the ring was really good at that show. But the promos, I mean, I remember it was Lawler and Doug Gilbert were going head-to-head in a promo. And I thought Doug Gilbert kept up with Lawler in a promo. And that's hard to do. I mean, this show, though, had it all. I mean, all the angles clicked on the show and stuff.
Yeah, and Doug Gilbert had the emotion. That's one thing about this angle I remember the most is that he was so emotional in delivering what he was saying that he looked like he actually believed everything he was saying was true.
Exactly.
So it was just such conviction going on here.
Right. And if you watch that angle, he has so much conviction that you think that Lawler actually didn't work the memorial show.
Yeah, when he did, yeah. It was always booked. Because Lawler always worked with Dennis Corluzzo. That's the funny thing about it.
And they were good friends.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just amazing. And, of course, Bound, Rich, and Gilbert are one of my favorite, you know, trios forever. I love them all together. Just great stuff all across the board. Now, the return to Monday nights drew 675 fans and $4,800 gate. For the Gilbert and Rich beating Lawler and Slasinger when Tex, who had already left, did the job. Because you remember, Tex quit and became Phineas Godwin. And this pissed off Randy Hales big time. Because it was in the next week of The Observer when that come out. And Randy Hales was building up Tex Slasher for a big angle. And then he quits. And PG-13 had a wild match with the Rock and Roll Express. Rich and Gilbert attacked them as they were coming down the aisle and injured JC Ice. Rock and Roll said that PG should forward into the match. But Wolfie did say take him on himself. After a few minutes, 2-on-1, Brian Christopher came out. Then Coco Ware came out and attacked Christopher. Then Ice came back out, but Rich and Gilbert came back out again, jumped on his leg, round up with Rock and Rolls, losing by DQ. Also in that show, Miss Texas regained the USWA women's title, beating Lady Satan, who was Debbie Combs at this time.
I was going to say, I was trying to figure out if that's Cora, that's impressive.
Yeah, that's Debbie. But, yeah, Bix, Brian Christopher and Coco Beware transitioned into a feud this time. And Coco did a really fun angle as well, turning heel on like the TV before this one, where he was doing the deal where he couldn't get booked, you know, and he had to figure out a way to get booked, and that way was to, you know, beat up guys like Brian Christopher. Memphis was so good at doing stuff like that.
They'd find just an in. For an angle, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, they find like a thread and they tug on it enough, and then they be able to exploit it. I don't know. It's kind of hard to explain.
Yeah, I mean, who does angles about guys not getting booked? Memphis was like the only promotion that did that.
I mean, it's not the same, but it sort of reminds me of the Ken Lucas angle from '79.
Yes,
where it's Lawler's now the seed. CWA World Heavyweight Champion, which they're treating as this real world title. And he has this match coming up, and you've got, I think it's the show, Lance Russell and Jerry Jarrett having like a, guess you could call it almost a booking meeting, right?
Yeah.
And it's like they're having trouble finding the good challengers for him. So it's like, here's Ken Lucas. And Lawler cuts this promo about, oh, whoever heard of Ken Lucas, which I'll ask, like, had he just never really come through the Memphis end of the territory before?
He worked Memphis.
But he was never a regular guy. And yeah, he was never a regular guy.
Yeah,
he was like a mid-carder.
Yeah.
So, and then, like, I don't know if it's the next week or if they were recapping it later in the show. So then the next thing you see, at least on the tape of it that's out, is Lawler cutting promo with Black Eyes after the match with Ken Lucas.
Yeah.
Great stuff.
And it's just very cool. And then Ken Lucas is now, you know, a legitimate, you know, world title contender.
Yeah.
And it's that type of thing. I think, like, throwing that in on top of the Coco Ware thing kind of explains what we were talking about.
Yeah. I mean, Memphis was very good at doing stuff like that. And speaking of all this, you know, what's going on, we go to the Potpourri section, and Buddy Fuller, who was involved in Memphis as a promoter at that time, and is the father of Jerry Jarrett. Real name, Edward Welch, a longtime major player as both a wrestler and promoter in the Southeast, passed away on January 15th at his home in Pensacola, Florida, at the age of 71. Fuller passed away from the effects of Alzheimer's disease, which he had been suffering from for many years.
Now, I want to issue a disclaimer, even though you said it and I didn't.
Yeah.
For
allegedly.
Well, besides that, a few weeks ago, I guess it was like a month or two ago now, Jerry Jarrett was on Jim Cornette's podcast.
Yeah.
And, oh, you didn't hear this? Okay.
Yeah, I did. I heard it.
Okay, maybe, maybe you didn't notice what I noticed. When they're talking about trading points in territories and how the Welches did that, and Jarrett says, I got in on that, and then later says, it was a family affair.
There you go.
And I was like, because they were very explicitly talking about it being this Welch thing, and I don't know if he wasn't thinking, I don't know about how it would sound or whatever, but it certainly sounded like he was saying they were his family.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting deal right there, that whole the Fuller, the Welches, Goldens, and you throw in this whole story now. Oh, man.
Wow. Fieldses?
The Fields, that's right, yeah. Southern wrestling, folks, man. I mean, it's a family affair in a lot of ways.
I don't think this was ever talked about publicly before Gary Hart's book, though.
No. I think Gary Hart was the first one to actually bring it up. But Buddy Fuller, I mean, guy was always around, you know, in this area. Different, but he was in different promotions, though. He'd be in Florida. He'd right. be in Georgia. He'd be in Memphis. He'd be in, you know, Southeastern.
Now, who's his dad? Lester?
Trying to think.
Is Lester the patriarch, or?
Let me see if I can find the Welch family tree here.
Whoever his father was. I've seen something, like, I think maybe from Robert Chute interview.
All right, Roy Welch.
The original Roy.
The original Roy Welch is the father. All right, Lester's son was Roy Lee Welch, okay? All right, here's the family tree.
Oh, boy.
All right, Roy Welch had kids, Buddy Welch, of course, Buddy Fuller, who had Ronald Welch and Robert Welch, Ron and Robert. Then you had Ruby Welch, who was Buddy's sister, who married Billy Golden, who had a brother, Phil Golden, and his son was Jimmy Golden. Billy's son was Jimmy Golden. And you had Jack Welch, who had – his daughter was Joan Welch Phillips. Then you had Herb Welch, whose kids was Bobby Welch and Doyle Welch. You had, you know, Lester Welch, whose kids were Jackie and Roy Lee Welch. And you had Bonnie Welch, whose kids were Albert Lee, Donald Wayne, and Luther Eugene, who was Lee Fields, Don Fields, and Bobby Fields, who had kids as Ricky Fields, Johnny Wayne Fields, and Shane and Randy Fields, who became referees. There you go.
Why would they need to book outside talent? I mean, geez.
And Buddy was supposedly, I don't know if he, is this true or not, but it says he, Buddy Fields, So one of them was Don Carson's brother-in-law.
I'm sure he was.
Yeah, there were four Welch brothers, Roy, Jack, Herb, and Lester, and they started in the business in the 40s. They were from Pawhuska, Oklahoma. That's the Briscoe's hometown, isn't it? But settled in Dyersburg, Tennessee.
And, okay, so there's no singular patriarch that was in wrestling. It was brothers all started in wrestling.
Yeah.
And then everything else.
Yeah, and the sister was Bonnie, who married Virgil Speedy Hatfield, who was a referee.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, so Roy Wells became a successful promoter with Nick Gulas, and then opened up the Gulf Coast Territory in 1953. And then, of course, that's the first generation. Then you had all the other stuff going on.
And Buddy took the Fuller name because his dad wouldn't let him use the Welch name.
Yeah.
As a wrestler.
Yeah, exactly. So there you go. Wow. God, I'm looking at this, and it's just so much. This is an amazing wrestling tree here.
Do they actually have the tree drawn out, what you're looking at? Or
Oh, I wish they did. That'd be even funnier.
And now, also, is The Rock their cousin?
Jimmy Snuka.
Oh, God.
And now we're going to go to a completely other screwed up family, WCW. And Vince McMahon may have finally shut up Eric Bischoff. As on the January 15th episode of Monday Nitro, yeah, that's funny, Eric Bischoff never mentioned the WWF on the air once, mainly because of the segment the WWF aired the previous week, which implied that WCW doesn't have a legitimate steroid policy. Wow, amazing. Now, WCW responded first with threats of a lawsuit, which would have little chance of success for a number of reasons, that the skit was labeled satire, that the performance portrayed Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage are both public figures, and both have an admitted history of steroid use, although Savage has labeled his history, quote, experimenting, unquote, and that there are a lot of legitimate question marks regarding the WCW policy. And then with Bischoff defending the policy in place, pointing remarks back at WWF by noting that three current WWF headliners, without mentioning any names, have failed steroid tests while at WCW. Of course, that plan of action wasn't well thought out, since none of the three performers were ever suspended for steroid use while with WCW. It is believed that all three headlined WCW pay-per-view shows immediately after such a positive test result.
And I think I know who one of them is. Although, actually, wait, he wouldn't be there yet. I was going to say Vader, because Bill Watts talked about him failing a drug test in his book.
Well, but... Sid, Davey Boy.
Davey Boy, I was thinking.
I'm trying to think of another one I'll read.
Who wins WCW?
Since when names were not revealed, Dave speculated about the last statement, although he had a good idea who they are, and that the last statement is probably accurate. At least one of the three, possibly more, did attend a counseling session after failing a test. It's well known that WWF did duty while with WCW, walked down the steroid test at least once, and was still promised the WCW heavyweight title, and would have won the title from Vader at Starrcade 93 instead of Ric Flair, who was planning on being phased out at that point to being a mid-card performer and had the incident in England with Arn Anderson not taking place. If anything, the admission puts more question to the current WCW policy. Nevertheless, the word is Bischoff's about face on Nitro, never acknowledging or knocking WWF during the show, and never acknowledging a few remarks by Steve Mongo McMichael when he broached the subject, talking about throwing away your channel clicker, is a response to the criticism of Bischoff the previous week, as his knowledge of WWF got in the way of getting over the wrestling he was presenting. It was a valid criticism, and Bischoff's response on January 15th of ignoring the steroid jab, a subject he best ignored until he's got real answers and a real response, was the best policy for three reasons. One, he was more focused on getting over his own product than the WCW announcing crew has been for a long time, which has been a major company weakness. Two, his reaction the previous week of name-calling came off childish. And three, that subject is something he best knows publicly until he has the real answers. Bischoff is expected to broach the subject at some point publicly over the next few weeks, where they'll give real answers and a real response to his next question. From early indications, statements released on his own hotline, and a newspaper interview, Dave thinks his response will be along the lines of saying that we have a policy and we don't have a steroid problem. Dave seems to recall that being said in wrestling before by some other guy, and it brings up the classic statement about those who don't learn from the lessons of history being doomed to repeat its mistakes.
I have a question.
Yes.
Is Too Cold Scorpio the only wrestler we know of that was ever actually disciplined as part of the WCW drug policy?
I know that he was one. I don't know of any others.
I mean, he's the only one that was fired over it, for sure.
Yes.
And it was wasn't that for marijuana positives?
I don't know, but it's funny, though, who he was, he got fired, if you catch my drift.
Say that again.
Who he was is why he got fired, as far as, I'll just say, his skin color.
I thought you were going to make a Terry Taylor joke.
No.
That's my job.
Yes, that's your job, but don't. What he's known for their, you know.
Well, it's that company, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So, of course, the black guys don't get fired.
Yeah, because those black people with their drugs and their... It's, you know, it's all those jazz musicians using that opium and...
They're smoking them jazz cigarettes, I tell you.
My point being, though, like, you know, the whole thing, you know, when Mons was running the company, he was like, I want to have a real steroid policy, you know, I want to clean this up. Shouldn't be a part of the business, etc.
Well, the famous story is about Sting.
He asked, right? He goes to Sting. He's like, "This." Well, I think Kip Fry started it. Then Watts was going to, you know, see it through. And he's like, look, you're my top guy. You know, I need you to get off steroids. Or maybe Sting went to him first. I think it's Sting went to him, right? I think Sting went to him and said,
asked him if it was going to be a real policy.
Right. He said, is this going to be a real policy? If it's a real policy, I've been on steroids for my whole career. But if I need to, but, you know, if it's a real policy, I'll get off steroids. And Watt said, it's going to be a real policy. So then various things happen. I'm trying to remember who Watts. I think Watts, the names Watts cited, I believe, were Vader and Rick Rude, right?
Yeah.
That failed. I think Vader, I think it was testosterone and had, or something like that, and had you know, some kind of prescription from a doctor for therapeutic use.
He went after Rude pretty bad in his book about how a guy his frame should never, or was his size was never natural and stuff.
Right, because, you know, Rude was fairly skinny off steroids.
Yeah.
Although he was always cut. I mean, he would be in cosmetic shape off steroids. He just wouldn't be as big. And the point was he wanted to even see if he could use it to, you know, renegotiate guys' contracts and stuff. But then it turned out that he couldn't even suspend guys because nobody's contracts had provisions that would allow them to be suspended without pay. WCW, everybody.
Yes. But, you know, one thing about this that I thought was interesting what Dave was talking about was the remarks on Bischoff's commentary, Pete. And it there's a lot of truth to what, you know, Dave's opinions there is. Bischoff spent so much time on early Nitros, like, trying to bury WWF and not put over his own product, that it's definitely noticeable when he, you know, actually does it.
Yeah. And it is also noticeable because Bischoff purposely said he put himself on Nitro because he, as the lead announcer, because he wanted to make sure what the other company was doing so he could attack them at all times.
Well, no, he hasn't said that.
And I can swear that's what he said.
No, he made himself the lead announcer because Nitro was his baby, and he felt that it was. I wouldn't be so vehement if I hadn't just talked to him about it earlier a few months ago.
Okay.
You know that he. No, he rejects that narrative. You know what he calls the phony dirt sheet narrative, that his thing was that, you know, it was his baby. He admits he was not nearly as good an announcer as Tony Schiavone, but he understood what he wanted to do with Nitro, so he felt he was the guy for the job. And, you know, he swears he did not have a monitor at the desk to see what was on Raw. The truck had a monitor, but that was only because their thing was to be in the ring when Raw went to a break. So, yeah.
The hot moments or whatever he called them or something.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, no, what Pete's referring to is a narrative from the past for many years, though.
Yes, the dirt sheet narrative. Actually, I can find.
Yeah, let me exactly. Find and Bischoff doing all these interviews lately has kind of, you know, I mean, yeah, sure, Bischoff, but I kind of believe him, you know, about that, you know, he wouldn't be on Nitro because, I mean, when you're a booker, you want to announce your main shows. Well, at least back then, all of them did it just about, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, there are a lot of people that, you know, think that's always a good thing when they do it. Like, I know Dave Prezak's a big fan of the booker as announcer thing.
Yeah,
for example, I mean, he's someone who does it, obviously.
Yeah.
Well, it all depends on who it is. You know, like, Bill Watts was really good at it. Would Dusty Rhodes been that good as the lead announcer doing it? I don't think so.
Well,
Dusty, it's different.
Right, but the one time he did it, I mean, he did it in WCW as Booker or some, but in Crockett, the one time he did it that everyone remembers is that Wyndham Ric Flair match, and he's amazing during that match.
Oh, I agree. I totally agree with that, but I don't think he could have done it on a without being too much Dusty, which would have hindered the product because he was too big of a star to be doing it. And it's one thing if you're the booker or the owner of the company doing it, but when you're the boss of the lead face and you're on commentary, it just totally wouldn't work, is what my point was more at.
Okay, and just for the record, it was the words he used were the wrestling dirt site narrative.
There you go.
And that's, if you want to read the whole Nitro article I did in Fighting Spirit, which has a sidebar talking to Bischoff about his reputation and his, like, that whole narrative about him in wrestling, that is Fighting Spirit issue 122, which came out in September.
There you go. Good plug. and name a dirt site, not name a dirt sheet. Now, WWF continued to play its billionaire Ted sketches, implying that WCW's wrestlers were on steroids and they don't have a legitimate testing all weekend. So whatever legal threats didn't seem to scare anyone off. A new sketch aired on the January 15th Raw, but this time it was put in the middle of the show rather than at the end, although it was constantly referred to both before and after. While funny, it really didn't have much of a punch. It tried to imply that Ted Turner wanted to buy the WWF, but he couldn't. That he wished he had Shawn Michaels instead of Hulk Hogan, which despite the relative in-ring ability of each is a joke based on each respective name value, and that all WCW was able to buy from WWF was a con man, Gene Okerlund, someone disloyal, Randy Savage, and a has-been from the 80s, Hogan. There's no arguing point one. There's some truth to point three, and naturally McMahon shows his incredible gall on point two. This is in business, and because a man gets a better business offer, someone in the business that lacks almost all efforts to begin with labels that person as disloyal. Wouldn't you think it would be disloyal to turn on the man who more than anyone else made someone in his company the financial success that they were at their peak and was a key beneficial witness to his acquittal in his steroid trial? Not in pro wrestling. It's just business. And Bix, this goes to the whole McMahon-Savage deal. You know, McMahon being seriously hurt, as we talked about in the show, when Savage left.
Yeah. Not to get into all the stuff about the rumors and whatever, but yeah, I mean, they, you know, they were friends. I think Savage, like Hogan had, Savage was living part of the year in Connecticut. It shook him, and I have to mention this just as an aside for a second. So my TV's on mute, but I have 2020 on, and I guess as part of doing a lottery-themed edition of 2020 because of the Powerball this week.
Yeah.
Guess who they have like a little feature or sub feature on in on 2020?
Hogan?
How does that have to do with the lottery?
I thought they actually named him something part of the lottery.
No. The Wrestlelicious guy.
Why is he on there?
Because he funded Wrestlelicious with his lotto winnings.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah.
And they showed him, like, apparently Wrestlelicious still exists in some form, and it was, like, an empty room somewhere, so I guess he's making those kinds of videos under the Wrestlelicious banner.
No.
But anyway, I was amazed that this was on TV, so I had to mention that. So let's return to talking about WCW.
I mean, this is just, you know, the Savage deal, Vince was, like I said, was just so hurt by that.
Well,
but,
Vince was unfair to him because Vince was like, "Oh, you don't have anything left in the ring."
Yeah, but I mean, Pete, do you think that Oakland was a con man? Do you think that Hogan was a has been? I mean, what do you think about those Hogan, comments? There?
Hogan was not a has been. He was drawing big money for WCW. I mean, let me rephrase that. He came in with a good contract, and he wasn't drawing WCW. He drew that big first buy rate with Flair.
He was about to pop some big money.
Yeah,
though.
But once he went NWO and got on that hot angle, he reinvented himself and became hot again. It easily could have happened in the WWF, and it showed that even when he came back years later, he was still had drawing power in the WWF or WWE and stuff. So was Hogan a has-been? No. Was Mean Gene a con man? I think so. He came across Carney to me, but I thought he was instrumental in getting his – I thought he was probably as instrumental as Bobby Heenan or Gorilla Monsoon in getting the WWF product over in the 80s. I think Vince was really hurt because I think these were key people who – I mean, and this is a young Vince McMahon really in the business in 96. I mean, he'd been promoting a lot, but pretty much from 84, when you think about it, his world champions were Hogan, Randy Savage, and maybe Bret Hart in 96 and Yokozuna. So – and you always
Warrior.
Heard that. And Warrior, yeah.
Flair, you know, I mean, there was other guys there, but yeah, I mean, he'd only been in charge for almost 14 years.
Yeah, and this is when Vince was still interacting with the guys and hanging out with them. So I think he did skew it as business and pleasure, and these were his friends, and who we happened to make money with, who I also worked out with, and I think he got hurt, and you know what, and then this is what Vince's true colors are, is being vindictive.
Yeah. Oh, you think? Yeah. And with Okerlund, let's be real, he was shady as hell during this period.
Yeah, Okerlund, the 900 deals and other stuff. Yeah,
I mean, the famous one is Jerry Blackwell, where a 40-year-old or a 40-something former world champion passed away. Called the hotline to find out who.
Yeah,
does his whole 10-15 minute updates. You're spending like $30, and finally, Jerry Blackwell passed away. former world heavyweight champion Jerry Blackwell.
And he used Nitro to plug that number and Saturday Night to plug that number. So he used WCW. Yeah, he was a con man. I'm not denying that.
Actually, the best one, though, was what do Magic Johnson and Davey Boy Smith have in common? Call the hotline to find out.
They got AIDS.
Oh, man.
No, for the record, they did not. I mean, neither of them have AIDS. Davey Boy Smith did not have HIV.
I know. Magic has HIV. But anyway, back to Nitro. Nitro results from the Night Center in Miami on January 15th before 4,200 fans, 3,100 paying with a $30,000 gate, saw Lex Luger beat Randy Savage in 5 minutes with a torture rack, star and a half. A lot of crowd heat with most cheering Luger. Neither looked very good in the ring, though. Next was supposed to be Kevin Sullivan and Hugh Morris versus Arn Anderson and Brian Pillman. However, the entire Dungeon of Doom and Four Horsemen came out and said they all had a common plan and it served no purpose to fight amongst themselves. Kevin Sullivan said he respected Ric Flair and Arn Anderson, but called Brian Pillman a punk. Pillman made some faces and Anderson slapped Pillman in the face really hard, and they seemed to tease that Chris Benoit was mad at Anderson when he slapped Pillman. There was already talk about breaking up the Horsemen, not that they were ever together to begin with. It was a great skit, but the lone negative was by having Giant out there with one-man gang. It is supposed that Giant isn't nearly as large as they make him out to be because he had only a few inches on Gang. Whatever problems Bischoff had, which caused him to nearly fire Pillman on the air the previous week, seemed to have worked out. That's interesting to talk about. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Public Enemy debuted and beat the American Males in 324 when Johnny Grunge pinned Marcus Bagwell in a negative star match. A few fans recognized Public Enemy and danced with him, and there was a very brief ECW chant during the match that almost immediately died out. Match had no heat, and virtually everything in the match was missed time. The only highlight was after the match when Rocco Rock did a somersault off the top rope outside the ring and put Bagwell through two tables, which got a nice pop. In the poll, PE got more first place votes than any other team for Tag Team of the Year. That's the Observer Award poll. The Males placed for Worst Tag Team, and the Males are tons better workers than PE. Ric Flair pinned Sting in 1335 when Luger came out to confront Jimmy Hart, got the megaphone from him, and inadvertently, as Sting came in for the Stinger Splash, got hit with a megaphone and was knocked out and pinned. 3.5-star match. Very good match, very good heat, very clever finish. But you know the other end of the coin. It's the same stuff we've seen a million times. Hogan, Savage, and Sting did an interview with Hogan and Savage telling Sting that Luger cost him the match. Sting left to ask Luger, and then Hogan asked Savage to give up his title match since he lost 4 in a row to Luger, and he was in a slump, and Hogan was on a roll. They ended up arguing. This probably has changed, or if not changed, somewhat reworked, but there was at one point a plan for Hogan Savage to break up at the Clash in Vegas. Hogan, in the main event, then pinned Ming in 438 after gaining the foreknowledge of Kim Sullivan and using it on Ming for a dud rating. Crowd was pretty dead for this one. All right, Pete. The highlight this showed to me, of course, is the Dungeon of Doom Horseman angle. And when Arn Anderson slapped Brian Pillman, the look on Chris Benoit's face is one of the things that I won't forget in wrestling. He looked like he was about to destroy Arn Anderson. I mean, it was class, and the cameras were perfect on that, getting his reaction. What do you remember about that angle?
I just remember the slap, because it looked like it slapped the taste out of Pillman's mouth. And it was great, because Pillman was playing that just cocky, smart-alecky heel. And I wanted to see him just slap the crap out of Pillman. But it was really cool to put a dynamic, you know, with the Horsemen and stuff. And it was different, because like Dave's right, you never saw the four of them together. They were the Horsemen, but like Pillman and Benoit would do their thing, and Rick and Arn were doing their own thing. So they weren't even like a real group, but they were called the Horsemen. So it was cool to see them all together on the stage, and then see other heels all together to that Pillman's such an obnoxious little jerk that it took all the heels, not all the heels, but the heels and the two big factions to get together to put a kibosh on Pillman. And I guess this was their starting point of that Apocalypse Horseman group that they never really went with, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
And also, as far as the Horsemen being, I think the only time they would have all four been together would have been Starrcade?
Yeah.
Yep, when Flair lost the title.
When he won the title.
The won the title, yeah. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, it was just weird booking in that time period for them, you know, involving the Horsemen members. And, of course, it was the Clash, you know, a couple weeks later when Pillman had his deal with Bobby Heenan. And, I mean, Pillman was quite the character this time, Bix. And this is like the beginning of it on the air.
Yeah. Like, really. And also that was, you know, the Clash was the week of NATP where Pillman took Dave Meltzer's badge to get into NATP.
Yeah.
And, basically played his character, so to speak, with Vince. Vince was convinced, I hated to say those words together like that, but I'm not sure what else I was supposed to say, that Pillman was a psychopath. Well, you know, he would had maybe an interest in him, or I don't know, although he would later, and Jim Ross was trying to convince him otherwise, and eventually, I think Pillman did something like to show that he was working. I don't remember the whole story, but yeah, he was wearing Dave Meltzer's badge to walk the convention floor at NACP.
And then what was it, the next month he did the Booker Man speech to Sullivan, right?
And then shows up at ECW Arena the following weekend. And
yeah. Now, you know, we talked about the Luger angle. I mean, Luger time period in the, you know, in WCW where he was, you know, half babyface, half heel and all that stuff. Just great work by Luger in this time period, in and out of the ring. Very strong stuff. And Public Enemy, Bix, I mean, we talked about this before too when they left ECW. I think we covered it on the Between the Sheets show from that time period, but it was definitely exposed time here. I mean, you definitely saw what was the real deal with Public Enemy.
That they were one old semi backyardish high flyer and one and his terror and his friend that they could have good first matches with.
Yes.
And that they had become a heavily protected garbage tag team.
Yeah. Now, real quick though, Bix, you know,
I know some people love Ted Petty as a worker, and maybe that's one of those things that you get if you were in the business, but I don't know. Cheetah Kid wasn't that good.
Yeah.
Especially when you saw him in the ring with better workers like Tom Pritchard or Liger or guys like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Always heard he was a nice guy, I'm sure he was a nice guy, but they were not good. And
they were a time and a place deal.
But even, I mean, it's still interesting that even with as much protection as they had, that they did have the good matches they had, because it's like, you know, some like the Pitbulls, who were probably much better workers than them.
Yeah.
Did not get nearly the praise, the fanfare, whatever you want to say. I mean, I think you would agree, right? The Pitbull, at least Pitbull 2 especially, was much better than either member of Public Enemy.
Of course. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think you could argue Mustafa was probably much better than either member of Public Enemy. Maybe even New Jack.
Yeah.
They just
were the right place for the Paul Heyman push.
They were the common denominator in the good matches.
Yeah,
that wasn't their fault. That wrong word, but it, you know, it wasn't them that made it the common denominator in the good matches. It was just that they were got the protection. And I'm kind of curious if like Heyman or anyone else was like helping them actually lay out the matches too. Or if it was just a matter of put them in like that kind of wild DCW arena brawl and it would be good. But like everyone else that they feuded with was really better. I mean, you know, Sabu and Taz. I mean, is there anyone I'm forgetting or is that about it? Bad Company.
Yeah.
I think that's
the Funks.
Raven and Richards.
Yeah, the Funks. Malenko and Benoit.
Yeah, I mean, some of them didn't have extended runs together. I mean, I think you can even say even Ian and Axel, even in 1994, were better.
So it is what it is. All right, moving on to non-television related stuff. All the wrestlers now have to leave their belts for the company officials after television tapings rather than carry the belts with them. Why is this, you say? WCW is paranoid after the Medusa situation of a retaliation taking place. Isn't that funny, huh?
Well, you know what, though? The wrestlers probably liked it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure some of them did. I bet Flair didn't, though. I bet Flair, when, he was the kind of guy that loved carrying his belt with him at the airport.
Yeah, and when he would put on the Flair show at the hotel bar or whatever,
that's right.
He needed to have something else to go with the robe along with the nothing else.
Yeah.
And the belt was perfect because the whole situation there.
Yeah, exactly. Remember, no penis jokes in this broadcast. But...
I didn't make any.
Okay. WCW has cut way back on budget for jobber expenses from $35,000 to $10,000 at the next Orlando tapings. So they will be using four more local guys and giving them hoods to make them appear different characters as they work more often but are arguably less qualified. There is not unanimous support within WCW for this decision. Now, Pete, this is pretty fucking cheap right here, man.
That's cheap. And
Florida and local guys this time period, not the best of workers either.
Yeah, I can't imagine this lasted very long. I can't even remember the hood, the mass jobbers that often in 96 at the syndicated shows, so I don't know. But that is pretty damn cheap, using a guy three times in that show with a mask. I mean, I remember seeing Mr. JL work as Mr. JL and then working as Jerry Lynn on a show. We're 2-2 twice, so maybe.
But yeah, I don't remember a plethora of mass jobbers. I'm thinking maybe they get
that's
up on this.
That's what I'm looking at right now. I'm looking at results, and there's not a lot. I mean, you have, guys that will work. You have Buddy Valentine, Manny Fernandez, not the
real one.
Famous Manny Fernandez, Leroy Howard.
Was Nasty Ned Brady around?
Yeah, Ned Brady may have worked. So Pepe Prado was a jobber on these TV tapings. Butch Long. Guys like that. But there's not a plethora of mass guys on here. So I wonder if that was misinformation or what. But, yeah.
Maybe they realized that they'd save enough money if they didn't have to trans guys, so they used more guys than they had planned and didn't have to use the masks and have guys
compete
as much.
Yeah. Now, regarding the clash in Vegas, the Torch reported that Roddy Piper is probably going to end up being Hogan and Savage's surprise. Piper and WCW began talking a few weeks back. Certainly with the clash in Las Vegas and that being where Ultimate Warrior promoted shows, WCW might be hoping fans speculate it's Warrior. Now, Biggs, this is an interesting story here because, Piper, of course, didn't show up until, October for Halloween Havoc.
And, he returned to WWF within a few weeks of this.
Yeah, as a commissioner. In fact, the next week.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It was the next week, right, that he became commissioner, a week after next? It was in January.
I'm trying to figure out if it was it the taping the night after the Rumble that they had
night after the Rumble.
And then he came out, and then Piper came out later?
Yes.
Okay. So, yeah, if it was that, then, yeah, that's when he was.
So, how about that? He's talking – he was talking to WCW?
Well, this is – when was
the
way. What day was the clash?
The clash was the 24.
Because it was Liz, I'm guessing they were in talks with Liz longer than a week and a half. I'm just going to guess that this was Liz and this was mistake.
Yeah, but Piper, I guess, was talking to them anyway, though.
Maybe.
Which would have been interesting for him to come in at that time period.
And, of course, Warrior was already talking to WWF.
Yes. So, yeah, interesting timing here on this stuff. Now, Iron Sheik was backstage at the January 17th Center Stage tape. He was looking for work. That's happened before, and he hasn't been hired.
I wouldn't blame him after what happened with his contract and all that.
Yeah, but Pete, 1996, Iron Sheik, I mean, really?
There's no money in him. There's no he can't even do effective jobs for people. Nothing. Yeah, no wonder he didn't get hired.
Maybe he was looking for managerial type work because, of course, that's what he did in WWF, later on with the Sultan.
But, yeah, could you imagine? I mean, if I'm Iron Sheik, of course I'm going to show up to center stage as much as possible. If I get hired, I stick around for 2 years and make $200,000.
Yeah, he knew the hustle. He'd been hanging around those smart Jews like he talks about.
Intelligent Jew.
Intelligent Jew, excuse me.
And he might, you know, Hogan might feel sorry for him and talk Derek into hiring him. Who knows?
Well, yeah, didn't happen, though. All right, now, we talked about this earlier, or we alluded to this. The January 14th issue of Dayton Daily News, weekly pro wrestling column by Alex Marvez, focused on the return of blading to the Big Two promotions. Wrote Marvez, why would anyone be dumb enough to mutilate themselves, especially considering the AIDS epidemic? Unfortunately, blood sells. There's a segment of the public that doesn't care about the health risk and simply wants gore. While the WWF didn't return the paper's calls, Bischoff said WCW doesn't have a blood policy, but did say blood will not appear on TBS or TNT. If someone is cut or decides to creatively get exciting inside the ring, I love that, it doesn't matter. Bischoff said the director knows he can't shoot it for TBS or TNT, and on pay-per-view, everyone turns up the intensity a notch or two. From time to time, stuff happens. Now, regarding the shots WF is taking at WCW on Raw, Bischoff said he didn't expect them to respond. I'm a little surprised they responded, Bischoff said, because people who worked for Vince in the past say he always espoused a theory of never acknowledging a competition. But in a different way, I'm not surprised. Desperate people do desperate things. All right, Biggs, thoughts on Bischoff's blood policy statements and his comeback on Vince there?
Well, in a few weeks, they'd kind of have the issue would kind of get forced on them because of the Tommy Morrison thing.
Yes.
At which point, everyone, including ECW, completely banned the blade for a little while.
Yeah, ECW was blood free for, I mean, it wasn't long, but
it was at least a few months.
Yeah.
And
this was probably the best year, by the way, too.
Creatively get exciting?
Yeah, I love that. I'm going to use that from now on.
Get creatively aroused?
Yeah, he creatively got excited in the ring.
That's really odd terminology there. But you know, he was right about the TBS and TNT. I mean,
I guess Flair got creatively excited a lot of times in there.
but he wasn't lying about TBS and TNT, and they did always pull back if there was ever hard with blood.
Yeah, you always remember that Regal Benoit match where they pulled away when I think it was Regal was busted open.
Oh, it was always Regal. They'd had whenever they headbutted each other, it was always Regal that
Regal
busted open. And then what else did he say here? With the desperate people do desperate things was his line, like his go-to line around this time.
Yeah,
because also when there was that blackout at Nitro, and he suggested that WWF did it, he used the same desperate people.
Yeah,
desperate people do desperate things line, and then it became part of the lawsuit.
Yeah,
and then he had to apologize.
It wasn't a part of it. It was because Mongo made it even worse, right?
Oh, Manga prodded Bischoff a lot on this stuff, too. Yeah, he was that extra. But Heenan would always sit there and, like, no-sell everything.
Yeah, he didn't always no-sell.
He hated that. I mean, Bobby would say that a lot. He always hated that when they would do that.
Right.
Because it wasn't good business. But Manga would get out there, he would egg Bischoff on, you know. There were, like, two schoolgirls out there.
And he'd always take digs at, like, the raw name and uncooked and...
Yeah.
And he'd always bust out. This is where the big boys play. Or, no, that was Bischoff.
Would, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the time period where they're showing the videos. Where they're showing the WWF guys.
That was their reply to... That was their on-air reply to Billionaire Ted.
Yeah, that was their on-air reply to Billionaire Ted. Was a show of Vinny Vegas getting destroyed by so-and-so. Or Dustin Rose getting... destroyed by so-and-so.
And Diamond Stud.
And Diamond Stud. And
I think, I'm trying to remember if they did it long enough for Cactus and Vader.
Cactus made it. Yeah. Vader, I don't remember.
I remember seeing him getting like pinned on television by somebody on they showed it. It was like a hot
Yeah. Movie. Yeah, those were always funny. Where the big boys played deals. Alright.
Had they done that before, or was it just Ole the one who did that before? In 84.
Ole was the first.
But, I mean, had WCW ever done it before?
No.
But but Memphis only had Memphis had Memphis was probably the very first.
Watts was the king of it.
Oh, yeah,
and then
the
Ole, and then Ole and Watts. But Ole was the only other one who did that specific style going into the commercial. Here's a clip of one of their stars losing to one of our stars videos.
Yeah, Ole would do it during the beginning of a show, though, early in the show. You know, he would talk about how great Ronnie Garvin was, and the match they would show was Ronnie Garvin beating up the Iron Sheik at the Omni. And Ole was like, well, Ronnie Garvin's taking this guy here, and they're like, totally like downgrading the Sheik, you know?
Yep,
and then Lawler and Hogan was a good, when they were talking about Lawler's coming in, it's like, all right, let's show Jerry Lawler. And Ole's talking about, all right, Lawler's taking away this big man here. So
way Watts did it on Power Pro was the best, though.
Oh, yeah.
Watts
was the he'd show the old match and then be like, okay, well, we've got a...
And he's treating it like it's like a match that just happened.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what's funny about it.
And it'll be clipped where it might be a 15-minute match, but he shows just like the 5 or 6 minutes of the ass kicking.
Yeah, he would show like Dr. Death body slamming and pinning Bundy in Houston. The Ted DiBiase Tito Santana match in Houston was shown numerous times.
Yeah.
Butch Reed and Iron Sheik.
Butch Reed and Iron Sheik. I mean, yeah, he loved doing that type of shit. All right, last story of the evening. On the January 13th episode of WCW Saturday Night, Mike Ditka, legendary Chicago Bears coach, said he managed Steve Mongo McMichael when he leaves broadcasting and starts wrestling, as if it were a fact. Naturally, on Nitro Monday, the idea of McMichael would become a wrestler wasn't mentioned. Of course, you know, it would happen down the line, but that would have been a natural deal, Bix, that they never did, was bring in Ditka to work with Mongo, at least for a shot.
Sure.
I mean, they could have done it in Chicago, in the Chicago area. It would have been huge.
Yeah.
I bet Ditka would want a lot for a payoff.
But didn't Mongo like leave for the Packers at some point or something like that?
Mongo played with the Packers at the end of his career, but he was still a
bad. Wasn't he seen like negatively for leaving specifically for the Packers?
No, Mongo was beloved in Chicago. In fact, I mean, he was when he quit playing, he had a TV show still in Chicago, and of course a radio show, which he still has.
Oh, that's right, his local Emmy Award.
Yeah, I mean, Mongo's one of these guys that everybody knew. Okay, you know, it was what it was. The Bears weren't going to resign. It wasn't, you know, it was one of those just where he had to go play somewhere else, and Green Bay offered him the contract. He was a main man.
Okay.
Let's put it that way. Normally, I would get what you're saying, and it happens a lot. But in his situation, it didn't matter.
I'm not as well-versed in Mongo as you are.
Well, you're not as well-versed in the NFL either. That's what he's talking about.
I wouldn't go to those lengths to learn more about Mongo. Only you would.
I think he lasted a year or two with the Packers anyway. It wasn't like it was.
Yeah, he played like 93 and he was either 93 or 94 or just 94, one of the two.
Yeah, it might have just
because
been
WrestleMania,
year, yeah.
We did WrestleMania in 95, he had just retired, basically.
Were the other guys on the LT All-Pro team active players, though?
I'm trying to remember who all was on that team. Do you remember? I think Richard Dent was part of that.
Reggie White.
I think Reggie White.
Yeah.
Was Bill Frelick around still?
Yeah, Frelick was on that.
Yeah, it was I remembered Frelick because he was also in the WrestleMania 2 thing.
And he was on the Intrepid too, wasn't he?
Yes. And also, wasn't he also the ex-boyfriend of one Melissa Hyatt?
Yeah.
Yes.
And did play-by-play with Jim Ross.
He wasn't on that team, though. Here was the team.
Okay.
I can't believe I forgot all these guys.
But I know Reggie White was.
Ken Norton Jr., who was playing. Chris Spielman, who definitely was playing. Ricky Jackson, who was still playing. Carl Banks, who still was playing. Reggie White, who still was playing. And Mongo, who had just retired. So all those guys were either just finishing up or still playing in the league.
Hmm.
And all were either linebackers or defensive linemen. And Ricky Jackson was a dude I would not have wanted to mess with. So
he might have been the best linebacker in football that year.
Yeah, Ricky Jackson was a hell of a player when he was old. That was when he was with the 49ers. He had just won a Super Bowl. And finally, after many years being New Orleans and not winning Jack,
yeah.
he got that Super Bowl ring that year, but Ricky Jackson was a scary dude. But anyway, on that note, we'll close the show out. Pete, what is going on with Titans and This Week in Wrestling?
I'm not doing this, but the guys from Titans are they're doing Mystery Science Theater, where they're watching old bad WWF house shows and doing commentary over it. I think Parv and Johnny and Kelly really enjoy doing that type of thing.
Well, I'll tell you this. The one I watched part of was the first one they did on the Capitol Center show. Uh-huh. And Biggs, I don't know if you've seen this yet.
Not yet.
But it's one of those things where you have to watch it to get it. I mean, you can listen to the podcast. It's not the same. You have to watch it because, I mean, it is a visual medium as they're doing the announcing over. And the way they produced it, they did a really good job of syncing everything just right where everything matches up on YouTube. So, yeah, check it out. I love the idea. In fact, I would do something like that myself.
Yeah, the guys are swearing by it. It just doesn't feel like me and stuff. But we haven't done a whole lot of Titans. And This Week in Wrestling, I have a guy named Timothy, and I felt we broke down the New Japan wrestling card probably better than any other podcast out there. And that's what some people have said. So it's not me just blowing smoke. So if you want to hear about the Tokyo Dome show, you can check it out and stuff.
Awesome. Bix, we haven't mentioned this lately on the shows, but talk about luchashop.com and what you can do if you punch in Bix.
If you punch in Bix?
Yeah.
That sounded painful.
I didn't say punch out Bix. I said punch in Bix.
That sounds even more painful.
That would be painful.
No, punching in me sounds even more painful.
We get Robert Fuller to punch in you.
If you could see my face right now, the disappointment would be palpable.
I had to get it in before the show was over.
So did he.
Oh, there we go. All right.
Okay, so luchashop.com, if you use the coupon code BIX at checkout, you save 10% on everything you order. Whether it's on sale, whatever, you get an extra 10% off all your officially licensed Lucha Libre merchandise. I believe they added more of the Psicosis and Rey Mysterio, like ECW anniversary poster things they did.
Yes,
I think Psicosis signed a bunch of them because they'd sold out of the ones he and Rey signed, but I think he signed a bit more, so they have more autograph ones now. And what were you saying?
And word I got this week is that their next issue of Rudo Don't Fail magazine, or Rudo Can't Fail.
It's Rudo Can't Fail. It's based on the...
There you go.
Wait, who's the song by? The Specials?
Yeah. So Rudo Can't Fail. They're doing a special deal about factions in Lucha. And they're trying to get more Ingo Bernalis merchandise in to, help out with that issue, to be a theme for it. So be on the lookout for that from them. But,
yeah, I was going to see it. I was going to think about if I wanted to send something in for that because it was like a faction, it has to be more than a trio. And I was trying to, I wasn't sure who I would pick. There's part of me that wants to say Los Boricuas.
The Regals were in my mind, but I picked Ingo Bernalis because Ingo Bernalis actually got me to buy something. So if you're getting money out of my...
Using coupon code BIX.
Using coupon code BIX, I save 10%. So if you give me the show some money out, then you're worth it for me. Also, I thought about Los Vipers, too, the original version, which were awesome. So, of course, Abismo Negro, Cibernético, Electro Shock, Hysteria, Psicosis 2, we talked about in this show. So that's a great faction as well. But what else is going on in the world of Bix?
Well, okay, so this is coming out Monday, so I'm trying to figure out, should I give the whole give away what it is? What should I do about say about my article that's coming out Wednesday?
Just give a quick tease.
Okay, so should I say where it's coming then?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, this is where I'll say where it's coming. So this Wednesday, I have an I have an article coming out at SB Nation Longform. That's sbnation.com/longform. Should be pushed on some of the other SB Nation sites too. where I talk about a second career that a certain well-known pro wrestler tried to embark on a few years ago and didn't really get off the ground.
Restaurateur. No.
Does this have anything to do with the Hulk Hogan sex tape?
No.
Because that's been your second career lately, I think.
Unfortunately, yes. But yeah, I'm really happy with how it came out. I think people are going to really, really, really going to like it. So that will be there on Wednesday at noon, I believe.
Awesome. Awesome, awesome. And
oh, yeah, and also, what, 605 Super Podcast?
Yeah, we cannot forget to mention 605 Super Podcast. Of course.
Of course not.
Coolest name of a podcast out there.
The great Brian Last and Bix talking about Mark Goulin this week.
Yes. We talk, among other things, we talk about Mark Goulin's promo where he introduced Tejo Khan in Memphis.
Great promo.
And then also, yes, well, sort of.
Great, not the great way.
Great to watch.
Yeah.
And also promised the debut of Yo Mamba, the Jungle Savage.
Outstanding.
We also talk about the great, great career of the one and only Hangman Bruce Pobanz.
Yeah, he's one of my local Georgia guys.
He's not a North Carolina guy? I figured because he went to Jimmy Valiant's school.
Wasn't it Brunswick? Glenn County? Wasn't it talking about he was running for politics or something?
Oh, I guess so.
Yeah, he's... it may not have been a native, but he lives here.
Fascinating individual. We also talk about the guy from Cocaine Cowboys, John Roberts, how in his book he talked about his bodyguard, who was a somewhat obscure but still known pro wrestler. And we cover that, talk about a bunch of other things, you know, go back through the archive, you know, last week's show where we had, the schedule's off to the previous week's show, you know, where we had Bo James and Tom Robinson on, had Jim Cornette on several weeks back, have a couple things planned, a couple other people on, so check that out at check that out at 605pod.com, and yeah, I guess that's enough for me for right now. And of course, follow me on Twitter at David Bix. And Chris, who you can follow on Twitter at Chris Zellner, that's KrisZellner. What do you got going on right now?
Well, XL on Bad Street. I figured I don't want to put anything between the Smoky Mountain shows. Let all three be in their own universe together. So won't be another XL on Bad Street until we do that show, which should be in a couple of weeks. So be on the lookout for that. Then after that, of course, got to figure out a time and a place to do the Scott Hudson, Steve Prazak extravaganza. Going to do a Continental show with Bo James coming up down the line. So there's some exiles in the future that we're definitely looking at. And on this show, we can go ahead and announce what next week's going to be about. Because this is one I've been waiting to do for a while now. Because next week, we will be discussing the week that was January 19th through the 25th, 1998. That's right. We're going to 1998 for the first time. And Mike Tyson appears on Raw. So that's going to be a very fun show to do. I haven't figured out the guests just yet. We'll get that hammered out in the next couple of days or so. So be on the lookout for that. But on that note, I'd thank Pete for doing the show with us.
Thanks for having me on, guys. Probably a fun time.
Thank you. Bix, of course, every week is always a pleasure. And, everyone listen to the show. Tell a friend listen to the show. Get it out there. Get the word out there. let's push this show higher and higher. Maybe we can get up in that top 10 list on iTunes or some shit like that. Let's try to move the needle here or something.
Or some shit like that, yeah.
Or some shit like that, that's right. Well, for Pete and for Bix, this is Chris saying so long from the Peach State of Georgia.